We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's Top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims and critically acclaimed movies while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
And this week,
Reservoir Dogs.
This episode is brought to you by our community on Patreon. They make this show happen and you can help. Links to our Patreon and merchandise are in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Nelson, good to be here.
Yeah, Nelson. We have another returning guest today.
And he's hammered.
Yeah. I'll give the audience 3 guesses of who it is.
Well, let's give him a hint.
Well, I was going to give him 3 hints.
Oh, okay.
You're going to give him three hints and then 3 guesses.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. They have like a, it's compounded by.
Yeah. And we're going to give him 5 hints. 5 guesses. The first 2 guesses don't count.
He already got the first hint. Like you've already, Tim. You just started talking.
And you said his name. And you said my name. Wow, those hints were okay. Really good.
So, first hint. His name is Tim. You know
what? Put in the comments right now who you think it is.
Second hint. He was here for L.A. Noire.
Yes. Or La Noir.
L.A. Confidential, okay. Which was like L.A. Noir, the game. Yeah. I get confused them.
Completely different than Avatar.
Third hint, he is our mysterious benefactor who lets us record in his office.
Our sugar daddy.
Yeah.
Hi, daddy.
It's nice. You guys are, as far as tenants go, you guys are just fine.
Yeah, for.
It's really, if there wasn't this space set up in this corner, I wouldn't even know you're here.
Did you like the gift we left for you last night?
Mm.
All the water on the floor?
Oh, yeah. That was.
We brought the rain.
We brought the rain.
But I told you that was supposed to go down in Africa.
The instructions were unclear.
Yeah, and we don't have the budget for that.
So. Yeah, we had a little flood in here last night.
Yeah.
But I got the shop backs out and cleaned it up, and no harm, no foul. So
yeah, we didn't bring any birds this time.
That's probably for the best.
No foul, yeah. Yeah, this week we're doing Reservoir Dogs. Tim, have you seen this movie before?
I have seen it many times.
Yeah, but have you seen it before?
Oh, no.
Earlier, did you see it? No, okay.
Yeah,
not before this. Nelson?
This is my first time. I've tried it before. I don't think I made it past the diner scene, but not because it offended me. I think, like, I started it, and then I had to do an errand, and I just never got back to it.
Yeah. This was my first dance with the film. I think I also tried watching it once before when I worked at a previous place. A buddy of mine let me borrow his copy and said, hey, it's my favorite movie. I think you'll enjoy it.
It's a VHS?
No, it was a DVD.
Oh,
it's very, Laserdisc.
It's very coarse, and I put it in, and I just, it is very coarse.
Yeah, I mean,
and at the time,
grandmother didn't enjoy it at all.
At the time, I was like, no. So, in all transparency, I wasn't married yet. I'm living in the upstairs of my parents' house, so I'm engaged, but I'm living upstairs. Yeah. And just, it was just a lot of language that I didn't just
language, gore, so, all the above.
So, yeah, I did not finish it. I didn't mind what I saw at the time, but this was my first time with it. I didn't get far enough in to know what the concept was.
I really got into Tarantino movies for a hot minute.
Is this your favorite one?
I would say my favorite, like, older one, like, his, I don't know.
This is his first.
Because Pulp Fiction is, like, iconic, and it's got John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson.
No, that's actually Nicolas Cage. They swapped faces that one time.
Oh, yeah.
When they were trying to break into Alcatraz.
People confuse them all the time.
Yeah. But of the newer era, I really like Django Unchained, which, from what I understand, you guys are going to be, you'll be doing that in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
This is
our Tarantino season.
Oh, good.
Tarantino
season.
All of them have their interesting things. Kill Bill was kind of like, I don't know. First I thought it was stupid, then I watched it again. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Just over the top. That's his style. Over the top.
Are they all
language
filled?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Language, gore.
So he's not done a movie that's been kind of reserved.
Okay. No. In fact, there's some arguments made that, like, he's all in the same universe. Like, all of his movies are in the same universe. He has been widely criticized for his characters pretty much being exactly the same. Okay. And I don't even know, like, some would say that he wouldn't even argue that. Like, they talk the same and they are the same, just different. He just puts them in different areas of the world in different situations and cultures. So
okay. Tarantino. This movie came out in 1992.
Yes.
Wow. I was five.
I was two.
Wow.
I was probably like 6 months old.
Yeah. Just a little puppy.
Yeah.
Fresh.
It's not a long movie. It's a little over an hour and a half.
You know,
and I appreciated the
before we
the
go length. There.
Yeah, what's up?
You know,
go where?
Continuing with the podcast.
Okay.
There was a electrician I used to work with when I was 18, and he'd say, "You're still wet behind the ears," and I didn't know what that meant. And it's really gross and weird when you think about
it. Yeah, it means you still have amniotic fluid on you.
Yeah. And that's when I just said, like, you were just a puppy. I almost said wet behind the ears. I'm like, that's such a gross thing to say.
Another one is
that really what that means?
Yeah, it means you're like,
I just assumed
you're
like
fresh out of the womb.
I assumed it meant like you're fresh and clean as in like you just showered and you haven't even dried behind your ears yet. That was my assumption. I'd never heard that definition before.
Literally means like you're wet because you just came out of the
disgusting.
It is disgusting. It's so gross. It's like, I mean,
why do people say that?
There's so many analogies. Like,
it means like you were born yesterday.
Yeah, but there's
even more so.
Or right, you could just, say you were born yesterday. Or like I just said, you're
funny
just a puppy.
To be grossier about things.
I guess.
But I didn't even know they were being gross the whole time.
I know. Well, now you do.
Now I feel dirty.
Now when somebody says it, you're gonna be like, oh,
next I've got time years you can of just, grossness. Like, mime swinging your umbilical cord.
All right, that's all I wanted to say about that. We can move on. Jeff's was broken.
That was fun.
The womb wetness, the womb liquid.
In all 70 episodes we've done,
you've never talked about being wet behind the ears.
That's the most interesting thing.
See, that's confusing and misleading for our audience. This is our 64th episode.
Okay, we've done 70 if you're a Patreon guest. So I'm just keeping track of all the movies we've reviewed. This is the 70th.
That is a separate show.
Yeah. This is the 70th movie we've reviewed.
But if you support these guys on Patreon, you can have access to all those extra shows.
Yeah. Those off 250.
It's just easy for me to keep track of. This is the 70th movie we've done.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't know why it's called Reservoir Dogs. It's one thing I wanted to look up, but I never got around to why it's called Reservoir Dogs. It has nothing to do with reservoirs or dogs.
No, but they are the Reservoir Dogs.
They are the Reservoir Dogs. I just don't know what any of that means. And it's probably, like some Tarantino movies, it's very literal, like Kill Bill. It's about killing Bill.
Hateful Eight. It's about eight hateful people in the room together.
Yep. Django Unchained. It's about a slave named Django.
Who no longer has a chain.
But there's other ones like Pulp Fiction. It's just, I feel like he just picked a cool.
No, Pulp Fiction is because it's in the style of a type of novel that didn't really exist in the time anymore.
See, and Jeff's probably been trying to tell us the whole time that he has the answer, and it's similar to what you said.
I specifically for Reservoir Dogs, I just Googled it, and the top answer of Google, the source comes from Far Out Magazine, but the little thing says, the closest thing Tarantino's ever give resembling an explanation is that the title popped into his head when he visited a production company. The company was full of unmade scripts, and they were jokingly described as Reservoir Dogs, as in dogs trapped in a reservoir tank and fighting for attention.
Oh. What a stupid way
to name
a
movie. So that's from Google.
So what you're saying is this is a bastard script that he made into a movie.
But if Reservoir Dogs means
that the individuals themselves have the same kind of antisocial behavior of dogs.
Do you think Tarantino's that smart?
Yes.
I think he is. I think he's just and we discussed this briefly before we started recording, quite possibly the worst actor of all time.
He is. I mean, you can't change anything. Like, and would you change it if you could go back in time? No, but he really just shouldn't have written himself into movies.
I've never directed a film. So I've always admired the people that have like directed and then self-acted. Like you see it a lot in like TV shows, like Stephen Amell would direct many episodes of The Arrow when it was on CW. I was like, how do you direct?
Or Jim Carrey directed The Grinch.
Right. Like, how do you direct from in front of the camera? It's like, I've always found it impressive. Now, this is my first time with Tarantino ever. I didn't think his acting was bad. I thought all the acting was a little over the top. So, like, him compared to everyone else in this film specifically, but maybe in other ones, I'll see it more. But, like, I didn't think he was terrible.
I think it's much more natural for an actor, especially like Jim Carrey, who's like he sees the big picture.
Yeah.
It's much easier for an actor to direct. Now what gets tricky, and there, you know, you have a whole crew, so it's not like you're the only one calling.
It's not
the shot.
Just him.
No, not just him, because there are things that you're not going to see because you're not looking at the frame.
Correct.
You're not. You know, you could have an AC that's pulling focus who sees something that shouldn't be in the frame, and they're going to yell. Someone's got to yell cut.
Right. Air conditioner pulls focus.
Yep, that's how that works. Assistant camera operator.
Yeah. Oh, would that be like the guy that works for the cinematographer? Because the cinematographer works for the director, but the director has the
cinematographer. Vision. Really, I mean,
he's just the camera guy.
Yeah, but also you have to be able to see the vision, the screenplay, make the right technical selections, work with the gaffers, which is lighting,
right?
And then your AC is doing things like pulling focus. They might be switching out lenses, like doing all the kind of manual stuff so you can focus on just getting in, capturing the moment exactly right.
And then even after all that, the editor comes in and says, no, that scene sucks.
Well, but that's the thing is the director's in it for the whole thing.
The director's in the editing room.
Director is in the editing bay and he is saying, like, I hate this. Get rid of it. We shot it. You know, we shot the scene 70 times. It's like, well, I like take 52 the best. And that's where it gets really diva. But then you can have a second AC who's pulling focus. So most of these cameras don't autofocus, especially those old film cameras that this was shot on. So there'd be someone manually racking the focus.
Have you ever thought of getting into...
Considering this was his first...
film production? Thought about it. Sucks.
Considering this is his first film, and we can talk a bit about how, like, the funding for it later, but considering this is his first film, how many people do you figure are behind the camera on a production like this?
On this size?
Yeah.
Behind the camera? I mean, I guess it depends on what you're...
You know, makeup, wardrobe.
What you're including, because, like, does that include craft services, which is, like, catering and stuff? Okay.
No.
Then I would say, like, probably... like a dozen.
Okay.
Yeah. Just because of the how small it appeared and like special effects were pretty minimal.
They're all practical.
Very practical. Yeah. They're practical. Not only are they practical, but
they're really good. That chopped off ear like cavity.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I was thinking more like the blood splatter packs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's very like
standard.
You could go out and do that with your buddies.
Yeah.
Like you could film the scene where they shoot the police off, like Mr. White shoots the police officers. I was like, dude, we could film this in my yard.
Do you guys want to?
Well, just real quick on that.
Yeah.
Mr. White's shooting them. Then they get in the car and drive off. And, they start running away, I should say. He's dragging Mr. Pink. They're running away. In the background, there's like 10 guys just like standing around.
Like, they probably didn't go through the right permitting process to like shoot that where they did.
Yeah.
And there's probably like an actual dock workers. Are like, what's going the hell?
Yeah. They all just like... And they didn't look scared.
Did you guys
scared,
just see that?
Right? And it kind of like ruined the immersion in that moment.
No, they probably weren't supposed to. They're probably not extras. They're probably legitimately like.
But it's funny to me that they didn't even bother to say, like, hey, could you get out of our shot for give us 10 minutes?
And this is where a diva directors, like, I'm like, if you were to ask Tarantino about that, he'd be like, well, that was intentional to show the. And you're like, no, it wasn't. You just have a low budget and you just.
Do you think Tarantino is so far up his butt that he would make up something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. That's why I asked about like the title, because I feel like that's one of those things where it's like, make up some story, like what you said. That could have been a complete story. He might have just been spitballing and was like, this sounds cool.
Yeah. And he said time to think about it years later.
The impression that I've gotten with him is like, he loves movies. Right, like all of his movies are homages to a bunch of movies, but like he strikes me as somebody that just like he loves movies and he also just likes making them and he doesn't take it all that seriously. But you think he's a little bit more? He considers himself a little more auteur.
I think initially he probably didn't, but I feel like as he moved forward in his career, he did.
Oh, okay,
I think that's part of why he writes himself into movies too. He fancies himself like a triple threat kind of person. And you're like, no,
fancy. I'd love to see him singing and dancing.
Yeah, you should just stick to writing and directing.
Is this the movie he acts in the most of all of his film that he writes himself in?
To my knowledge.
Is this the biggest role?
I know there's one where Selma Hayek rubs her feet on his face.
Yeah, he's a foot guy, turns out. He's got a foot fetish. And
so he wrote that scene in, and then that's the only scene he's in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean...
Which one is that?
I don't know.
It's one of them.
I don't know.
Selma Hayek...
isn't really known for her feet.
Try to think of that's not the,
I think when you're a foot person, it doesn't matter. That's
not the Kill Bills, right?
No,
it's like
that's Uma Thurman.
Like my little toe is like it looks like a cashew, and there's really no toenail.
I mean, to tell you,
and I bet I would imagine that he'd be like, oh yeah, that's like just different, you know? It's like it's different.
Let's do this scene again.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's a big foot guy.
So 1992.
I do. So let's talk. I mean, we're on topic of Tarantino here. We haven't made it real far. Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill 1 and 2, Sin City, Grindhouse, Inglourious Django Unchained, Hateful Eight, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is his most recent one.
Yeah.
I've not seen any of those.
I've seen Inglourious Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Django Unchained,
Okay.
And now Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, the only one I think I haven't seen is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Okay,
you're caught up.
I quite liked it.
I watched Sin City quite a bit. It was just so different.
If you were to guess, because you've seen basically all of his movies.
Yeah.
Which movies do you think of his are likely in the IMDb top 250?
Ooh. And this one is in the top 100.
You know two of them already.
This one's in the top 100.
Yeah, obviously Reservoir Dogs is in there.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Pulp Fiction almost has to be, right?
It's in the top 10.
Is it? Yeah.
And Django Unchained, we do in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other two are Inglourious and Kill Bill Volume 1.
I was going to guess Kill Bill as well.
Grindhouse, Sin City, Kill Bill Volume 2, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood have all been in the top 250.
Sin City was just, like, to me, mind-blowing. Probably because it was monochromatic and...
Yeah. Like all just green screen.
Super high contrast, yeah. And just the story too. And like, it just
Bruce Willis felt weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a little bit unsettling. I liked it.
Sin City came out around the same time as 300, right? Because 300. Mm-hmm. So the reason I haven't seen that one, or I have also not seen 300. So like,
Zack Snyder.
And both of them are
best
like,
movie, in my opinion.
Both of them, like the animation, the live action animation was a turnoff for me. So like, yeah. It's the reason I remember when Sin City came out. I'm like,
yeah. Well, both
no.
of them.
No. And then 300, I'm like, this animation just, I want to just see a live, like, I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen either of those films.
From comic books. Are they both adapted from Frank Miller comic books?
Is 300 a comic? Because I know it's, yeah. I mean, 300 is also a real moment in history.
Well.
There's also a comic base.
Yeah. The movie is a pretty close adaptation of the comic book, which is a very loose adaptation of what happened.
Gotcha.
So Sin City is definitely Frank Miller. Let me double check on 300.
Okay. If it's the same,
also Frank Miller, yeah. Yeah,
because
he has a very
distinctive
visual style in his comic books.
So. Then that makes more sense. What about 301 or whatever? Wasn't there a sequel to 300?
300 Rise of an Empire.
Was that
sequel.
Any good? Have you guys
I think any sequel is not worth watching.
It's based off of Frank Miller's graphic novel Xerxes. So yeah, it's still adapting from that.
I didn't know that.
And Frank Miller, like a lot of his stuff has been adapted.
Yeah.
You know what you guys should do?
He did The Dark Knight, by the way.
You should, speaking of bad things, you should... do the opposite of the IMDb top. You should do the worst movies.
No, we talked about it. When we were wrestling with ideas,
I think you should throw it in as like a 100th episode. We're going to do like the newest Matrix movie. No. Just one of the worst movies of all time.
We did talk about doing like the bottom of the pit too.
Listen, so
like,
some of the movies we've done for this have been, in my opinion,
bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
I just watched Mad Max recently, which I'll talk more about that in a later episode. But like, the first one is...
It's a garbage movie.
It was a horrible movie.
You mean the Mel Gibson version?
Yeah.
The old ones?
1979.
They are so slow.
Yeah.
Like, those movies are
but like
so
also
slow.
Slow and chaotic at
chaotic,
the same time.
And then also horrible special effects.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, across the just, board. Yeah. But like, it's just like, okay, I would compare it to like okay, Ringo Starr, drummer for the Beatles. Everyone thinks
familiar.
Revolutionary drummer.
Nah.
If you compare him to any drummer in the Common Era, he is... bad.
Hold
like,
on.
Not bad, just not...
You and I have discussed this before.
Yeah.
His ability to hold a shuffle beat for very long songs. Like, I don't think there's a... I think he's underrated. Like, not, I think that he is unfairly crapped on, considering how well he... Like, he... a lot of drummers, if you gave them that shuffle rhythm to hold for a long time, they're going to struggle.
Yeah.
They're going to struggle.
I don't mean to crap on him. I'm just saying, like, if... Like, I love to see, especially people who aren't musicians, say... Like, this is the best drummer of all time. You can never say that about anyone because someone else who's going to be faster, they're going to be more in the pocket, they're going to be better at gospel or jazz or some like really intense.
They're all
going to
have their niche.
Yeah. So, but I would.
Yeah. But how many drummers do you know that could write something as beautiful as Octopus's Garden?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Because you're both drummers and I used to play drums.
Oh. But anyway, I would liken that to what were we saying? Oh yeah, the IMD, the bad ones.
The bottom of the barrel.
That
it'd essentially be B movies, right?
It would be so much worse.
Yeah, it'd be worse. But like Mad Max was probably in its time, it was like, this is so profoundly good. And and then you watch it now and you're like, this is, I don't even know what's happening. It's just stupid.
I don't know. This movie came out, Reservoir Dogs, that is, came out in 92. We've not done any other movies from 1992 yet, nor 91. My chicken nuggets are coming back. But in 93, we've reviewed three movies so far that have come out in 93. Jurassic Park, Groundhog Day, and A List by Schindler.
Oh,
all of which came out in 93. So This is the first 92 movie, though. Nelson.
One second here, because I want to pull up what other movies in the top 250 that we will be covering in that. Two other movies in the top 250 from that year, Unforgiven and Aladdin.
Unforgiven.
Aladdin, like the
animated
movie?
That's right.
Robin Williams.
It's a great movie.
And then in 91, we'll have Silence of the Lambs and Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Ooh.
Which Terminator 1 is not on the top 250.
Correct. It's called The Terminator, and it is on the top 250.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Both of them are on there? Yeah. Okay. For some reason, I was thinking it was
just not called Terminator.
I thought it was just T2. Okay.
You just lost all your credibility.
Well, I have never had credibility, so joke's on me.
I think you're credible.
I personally, what was the first one? Not Terminator, but the, what was the first?
Unforgiven.
Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, that's like great. I mean,
Lindsay's seen that movie. She is traumatized from a couple scenes. I've not seen it yet.
Who is Lindsay for our listeners who are just tuning in? You gotta do it in the Borat voice.
My wife.
Yeah, there you go.
I've never seen Borat.
Your credibility as a movie reviewer.
I'm double checking right now. Yes, the Terminator is on the top.
Okay, I believe. I just.
I love his quips, by the way.
Sasha Baron Cohen.
No, Arnold.
Jeff.
Blow some steam, Bennett.
Get to the chopper. Yeah. There was a band back
need your jacket,
in the early 2000s called Austrian Death Machine.
Very good.
Yeah.
And it's mostly all the members from the band As I Lay Dying and a metal band. But all of their songs were based around Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Mm. So they literally like had songs that started with Get to the Chopper, and they all wore Arnold Schwarzenegger latex masks.
Wow.
I've seen them live once. What's the music festival that was
running? The Alive Festival.
That's right.
I was there.
I saw them live at Alive.
That's your brother's band played that year, too.
That's true.
And that's in my brand played there as well that year.
And
what a weird
Arnold as the Terminator. He had a Terminator mask with like a bullet lodged in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And he fought the Predator on stage. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. It was a fun show. I really appreciated it. Nelson. Is Reservoir Dogs based on any sort of writing outside of this screenplay? Okay.
Tarantino invented all of it.
Okay.
Which gives me some questions about Tarantino because
I
understand like he likes putting strong language in, and when you're using strong language, the N-word's such a tempting one. And as I've said in the past, that juice ain't worth the squeeze, in my opinion. But he uses it. He uses it liberally.
In all of his films? Mm-hmm.
Usually it's black people or explicitly racist people doing it, but in this movie it's not. We're going to talk about that in a minute.
Have you ever heard Conan O'Brien do like a parody of like a 1920s gangster?
Yes.
Yeah. See, I feel like that's who Tarantino is. He's that person where he's like, thinks like, obviously Conan, it's a bit, he knows it's not how people like talked every day. Like,
have you seen Shane Gillis's most recent stand-up special?
Yes, where he's talking about the baseball players. They're like, Shorty's coming up to the plate, and he runs a 5-3. He's the fastest man.
Man alive. And then he's like, that was the when coolness was officially beaten out of white people. And here we have Jackie Robinson up to the plate, a colored fella. Let's see how he does. Oh, wow. Well, that was incredible.
Yeah. And that's when...
I guess I like golf now.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, golf, computers. Anyway, sometimes...
I think I need to listen to Shane Gillis.
He's hilarious.
Sometimes I feel like Quentin Tarantino is the real-life embodiment of Conan's...
impersonation.
...bit of that person. Like, he's a character. Caricature.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks that's how real life happens. Like, even when I watched the diner scene again today, the very opening scene, like the way they're BSing, like they're career criminals. I'm like, this is not how this works.
No,
they most definitely would not be seen in public together, especially after going to all the trouble to create the aliases.
Right.
Like, this would be this is pre cell phone. They'd be using pay phones to communicate. They would probably wear masks for everything. Like, if they wanted to be
leather gloves,
truly anonymous.
Well, also even just like, let's get through our production notes and stuff before. I want to talk more about that scene too.
And Tim, real quick, we kind of glossed over this, but just for anyone who's joining us for the first time on this episode.
I'm a little glossy right now.
I hope so. We got a couple questions we always ask our guests.
Oh, yes. I hope they're political and religious.
They're actually very religiously, politically charged.
Perfect.
So this is just to give our listeners a chance to get an idea of where you're coming from. So anyone can go back and listen to our LA Confidential episode where you have answered these questions already. But if there's anything you'd like to add to these, feel free. If not, that's fine. But first one is, Tim, how would you describe yourself when it comes to politics? What are your political biases?
Politics? Boy, I hate being labeled as a libertarian because I really don't like labels, but that's kind of in essence what makes a libertarian a libertarian.
That's right.
So I'm surprisingly left-leaning on some things, and on some things I'm staunchly conservative, but I definitely fall deep, deep into the anti-authoritarian camp. So on the litmus test, which, by the way, have you done since the last episode?
Lipschitz?
Yes.
Dr. Lipschitz from Rugrats?
Yep. How did they get away with that, by the way?
Rugrats is beautiful. I did take the political test.
Yeah.
Let me get the picture on my phone here.
I don't need to know.
Okay. Nelson, where would you describe?
I'd say
his bottom left.
He's halfway down.
Okay.
And about a quarter of the way left.
Okay. So I was fully down as far as you can possibly go. I
bet you were.
And I was left
down to clown.
Like maybe 5 to 10%.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dead center down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very anti-authoritarian.
And I am as far bottom right as you can get.
Oh man. I'm surprised you guys don't kiss more often.
Not on air.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You wouldn't be able to hear it anyway.
We'd lose all of our viewers.
Both of them.
Okay. Religious biases. Anything else you'd like to add when it comes to how you see religion, faith, anything in that category?
I'm kind of a bro-ligion kind of guy. I just made that word up.
That's dope, dude.
Yeah. No, I don't know.
Get it.
I don't try to indoctrinate. I try to let people see that I have something special, and if they want it, this is how I go about it. But I'm not like dragging people into a church. Mm. So.
But you're also very involved in your church.
I am very. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm kind of an anomaly. Not an anomaly. I'm a paradox.
Surgeons standing close together.
Yeah. I don't really love the establishment of the modern church, but I also firmly have committed my life to it. So it's weird. I don't know.
Or to Jesus.
To Jesus. And okay. It as a vessel. Right. That.
And you've been at this church for
20. I was 6. And I'm 36. 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, guy.
Big guns.
Basically, like, as long as that church has been there.
Yes, the church is a year older than me.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I don't think it's anyone.
Have you seen any movies recently? Since the last time we've talked, have you watched any other, movies or anything? Movies?
I feel like there has been stuff. I have to look at my Netflix queue. I've been really, like, turn it on and fall asleep lately. I've just been in a good season of life for me is, like, going to bed early. And
preach.
Yeah, and, like, sleeping through the night and waking up early. So really, I start things, and like I've been getting into some like kind of like darker anime lately.
Really,
I don't know why. It was suggested, and I some of it I love, and some of it I'm like I don't.
Anything you'd recommend?
I'd have to look at my Netflix feed because I don't even know how to pronounce half this stuff. So,
Yu-Gi-Oh,
Pokemon.
It's like one of the only categories in Netflix that's like Netflix published that I think I actually like.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of it is just we talked about this last time. They regurgitate stories, actors, characters,
recirculating everything.
Yeah. But like the anime, but
now my diverse.
Yeah. So anyway,
That's interesting. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Our guest in 2 weeks is a big anime fan.
That's right.
So
who's your guest in 2 weeks?
Isaiah.
Oh yeah, he would be. Yeah. What a weirdo.
Yes. So thank you, Tim. Thank you for letting us dig in a little deeper there.
Yeah. Dig in, Daddy.
Continuing with the movie. Notable cast. So I don't know why I'm tearing this, but I'm going to share this. It's my show. Part of my show. I'm half of this show, is what I'm trying to say.
You should talk more about the show.
When, you mean this one?
Yeah. Wait, you're half of the show?
Right, I'm half. Okay. Well, I'm half
some
of the
weeks
show.
You're a third.
Today I'm a third. But in general, like, yeah.
Wrecked you, dude.
Yeah, percentages are hard. When I would think of this movie before watching it, I always assumed that, like, I knew a lot of people on the cast.
Yeah.
And then like right before going to watch, or I think actually Nelson and I talked about it Monday. I was like, okay, that's the next movie. I'm getting ready to watch it. And looking at the cast, I'm going, I don't know any of these people except for two. But in my mind, I'm like, when I think of this movie, I always thought it was a cast that I was familiar with everyone.
Well,
but what I realized was I was getting it mixed up with Pulp Fiction, like pictures of Pulp Fiction, which I knew John Travolta wasn't in this one, but just like for some reason I was thinking Samuel Jackson was in this.
Yeah.
And then there was another image I was just picturing, and that had nothing to do with this film. I don't even know what image I was fabricating, but yeah. So of this cast, we've got Harvey Keitel, which
that's Keitel.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I don't know who, I don't know him. There was like, I mean, I know some stuff he's been he's in, done but like some
Wes Anderson stuff, and okay. So we're gonna see him again in Grand Budapest Hotel and Moonrise Kingdom, and then he's also in a bunch of Tarantino stuff. We're gonna see him again in
a lot of these will be returning Tarantino's. Yeah.
We're also going to see him in Apocalypse Now and Taxi Driver.
Okay.
Part of the familiarity, which you're almost like the Mandela effect you're describing, is because Tarantino has like a very small cast that he works with on a lot of things.
So and
like,
a fairly specific style.
Yeah, for sure.
It's specific, like just the guys walking down an alley with the black suit coats, the black tie. Like, and I know like, okay, just that image, but I just, for some reason, I thought I knew everyone in the cast. But anyway, the next one up is Tim Roth. Now, Tim Roth is an actor I know.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He's funny. Good he was actor. Great. I thought he was great in this movie. He, from Marvel, he's the Abomination in the Marvel
universe. Yeah, he had a TV show called Lie to Me, where he was he was working with the FBI because this. Like he was an expert in micro expressions.
He was the villain in Rob Roy. If you've seen Roy.
I've not seen Rob Roy. I've had the drink.
It's a great movie.
It's a good drink. He's also in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Hateful Eight, and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. So he tends to use he'll be the back. Same
Michael Madsen, another person that, like I feel like I've seen, but looking through his roster, I'm like, you're not any notable characters from anything. But he's in this. He's also going to come back in a couple different
Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, Hateful Eight, Sin City, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Similar to how he recycles characters and he recycles cast. A lot of the actors themselves are pigeonholed. Like Mr. Orange, what's it?
Tim Roth.
He's one of the few that actually has been in many different genres. The rest are kind of pigeonholed into like the one you just said. He's always like the smug kind of douchey gangster.
Yeah.
Like he always, and he's in other projects that aren't Tarantino, but he's always that character.
Good example of somebody that's certainly not pigeonholed. And I surprisingly probably the most prolific actor in this movie is Buscemi.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the one
So this wasn't even his first role.
No.
He'd already done Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink with the Coen brothers. And he's in Hudsucker Proxy. We saw him in Fargo. We'll see him again in Big Lebowski.
Con Air, right? Which is not top 250
movie.
He's
also Con Air.
But he's in Con Air with Nicolas Cage.
And then he's also in Pulp Fiction. And then where I knew him from until I got into Coen brothers movies was Sandler. Because he's in Billy Madison, Wedding Singer, Big Daddy, Mr. Deeds, Grown Up 1 and 2, Ridiculous 6.
Have you ever been pigeonholed, Jeff?
No.
My therapist told me that I shouldn't talk about it anymore.
I've never been pigeonholed, but I've had holes near pigeons.
I've been cloacaed.
So, I've been pigeonholes adjacent. I got Chris Penn.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, he's more Chris Penn. Again, I thought he did a great job in this movie.
Looks like Jonah Hill.
I can't place him anywhere else, but then Edward Bunker. I thought he's one of the main casts. And then you've got Quentin Tarantino, who in this movie is one of the leading casts. He's not just a cameo or whatever.
And then not on camera, but the radio voice.
Yes.
That's Stephen Wright. Stephen Wright. Oh, man, he's absolutely hilarious. You need to look up a stand-up. It's super, 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 super dry. Just like one-liner after one-liner after one-liner. And like basically, as soon as you get the joke and start laughing, he's on to the next one. One of my favorite of his is I spilled some spot remover on my dog and he disappeared.
Nah.
It's just super corny stuff like that. And I love it.
Yeah.
Check him out. You'll
did he ever find his dog?
No.
Oh,
wow. Shoot.
It's not even funny. That's not funny.
Don't joke about that. Now, before we get into the ratings and stuff, would this movie be considered a dark comedy or is it just an action thriller? Because there were moments in this movie where I'm like, that's...
Comedy has changed.
Right. And and we've gone down some dark comedies on this podcast and stuff that I've never experienced before. And there's aspects of this movie that feel out of place, which is how I would describe a dark comedy. Things that are happening. Even my wife's watching the Fargo series right now, specifically the newest season, because she likes
enjoying them.
She's loving it. It's a little weird. And she's like this one
can you say Fargo?
Fargo.
But in your Canadian.
Fargo.
Thank you.
She's like, she thinks all the actors and actresses in this series are good. But at the same time, she's like, the storyline's very similar.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I know it's a dark comedy. She's like, I know it's a dark comedy, but they're not telling jokes.
No.
But somehow there's still moments. I was like, it's moments that don't naturally happen. that are maybe uncomfortable or inconvenient. Like, that's how I was describing it to her. There's some of those moments in this. This is not a Fargo, Coen Brothers type of movie, but there was similarities.
I would say that there are aspects of this movie that are dark comedy. I don't think the comedy in this movie lands as well as Coen Brothers' dark comedies.
Okay.
Well, thank you, sir. That's not necessary.
Now, when you say you don't think it lands, do you think it's just we're not catching it and the jokes are there, or like the shticks are there, or
I think the Coen brothers are better at dark comedy than Tarantino. Okay.
But you would say that there's dark comedic moments in this?
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
Do you agree with that, Tim?
It's way more toned down, like Pulp Fiction.
This movie compared to other ones, is there more of his movies that would be more on the comedic end? Or like, are they all more action thriller with just dark comedy adjacent? Like, or would you say this is on one side of what he does?
Of what I've seen, I'd say he certainly gets better over time at dark comedy.
Okay.
Would you agree?
I would definitely agree. Okay. Inglourious Bastards, Django Unchained, there's all kinds of moments in there that are like, they're not even like hard.
Subtle?
Yeah. They're not even, some of them aren't even subtle. They're just like just on funny. The nose funny.
Yeah.
Like, okay. This is funny.
I'm excited to watch Django Unchained, I think.
Django Unchained's good.
Nelson, am I going to like this movie?
It's hyper violent.
I'm excited for you to watch Django Unchained.
Oh, no. Oh, Lord. Should I watch it with my wife?
I'm curious how she'll respond. So an interesting thing about this movie, one of the influences on this movie.
Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
Okay.
Was a movie called Django.
Okay.
And so I fell down the Wikipedia click hole, and Django like Unchained
clicks and
we'll talk pigeons. About this more in a couple weeks. Django Unchained is even more of an homage to Django.
I don't even see the correlation there,
so I'll explain more about that later. But there's a lot of hold on, I have it here, so I want to talk a bit about production. The film contains multiple homages to other films. Tarantino himself said that Reservoir Dogs was influenced by Stanley Kubrick's 1956 noir film The Killing. The film's plot was also inspired by the 1952 film Kansas City Confidential. Additionally, Joseph H. Lewis's 1955 film The Big Combo and Sergio Corbucci's 1966 spaghetti western Django. And looking at some of the other movies and where he gains inspiration from, like, none of them are super well known. So, like, Tarantino is like a film junkie, you know. Yeah. He likes the deep cuts. Exactly. That's exactly right. And he was working at a Video Archives, which is a video store in Manhattan Beach, California, when he made this. A couple other people that were going to be in it but were cut. John Cryer was asked to audition, but he never showed up.
Which is Ducky from Pretty in Pink. And the
he's making this up.
2 and a Half Men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Viggo Mortensen, which is Aragorn from Lord of the Rings.
Oh.
And George Clooney. Oh. Also read for roles. Tim Roth's agents originally wanted him to be Mr. Pink or Mr. Blonde, but he wanted to be Mr. Orange. He's British, and he thought it would be interesting to be an English actor pretending to be American, playing a cop, pretending to be a robber. And then Joe is played by Lawrence Tierney. Tarantino said that everybody hated him by the end of the first week of production.
Wow.
And then this movie's been remade.
The Reservoir Dogs has.
Yes. So Conti, Kaante, is a Bollywood film in 2002. It's a remake of Reservoir Dogs combined with elements of City on Fire, which is a Chinese film. And Reservoir Dogs is actually an homage to City on Fire as well. The film also borrows plot points from Heat and The Killing. Tarantino has been quoted as saying that Conti is his favorite among the many films inspired by his works. Tarantino later screened Conti at his new Beverly Cinema alongside Reservoir Dogs and City on Fire.
Wow. A lot of information.
Oh, there is a Taika Waititi television show on FX called Reservation Dogs.
It's very good.
I've not watched it, but
Taika Waititi's involved in that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
You guys just make up words the whole time you do this.
Most of the time, yeah.
That's
and some people listen.
In fact, that sounds like something you'd eat at a Chinese restaurant.
Reservation Dogs?
No.
Taika Waititi?
Yeah.
He's a director from New Zealand.
Like, I'll take
he's Maori.
I'll take General So.
He's brilliant.
Sweet and sour chicken.
He's a good looking guy,
and some
too.
Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
He's a good looking
pork, guy. Please.
He did Jojo Rabbit, which is one of my favorite
Jojo Rabbit's a phenomenal movie. He plays Hitler in it.
I highly recommend. If anyone,
he plays a young Nazi youth's imaginary best friend, Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, you guys are weird.
No, it's a fantastic.
It really movie. Is. It's really.
You need to watch JoJo.
Surprisingly charming film.
Rebel Wilson, Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rebel Wilson.
Yeah, she plays a Nazi SS officer. She's
wonderful.
She's hilarious. All right.
She's okay. She's not my favorite. Scarlett Johansson. She is ruined for me because I hate comic book movies for the most part.
She's one of those actresses that because she's so buxom, people say things like all of her talent is in her bra. But I think she's actually a really phenomenal actor.
I think she's great.
I think she's a good actor,
I've seen her in a lot. I like her more outside of Marvel than I do inside.
Yeah. Anyone who's been like, yeah, she's so much the face of it for such a long time that it's ruined a lot of actors for me.
Yeah.
And they're good actors.
What about directors?
Yeah, I can't stand the directors. I can't stand anything that is with Marvel. I can't. Yeah. I can't. And actually the Star Wars too. The same. Hmm. It's ruined it for me.
So you don't like Spielberg?
No, not current. I mean, maybe past Spielberg, but.
Well, past Spielberg would have been Star Wars.
Yeah. But original OG Star Wars. Yes.
Okay. Okay. I'm following. I'm tracking.
Yeah. But even George Lucas, I'm kind of mad at.
Yeah.
He really sold out. And why?
So
money.
How much money
from day one, the whole thing was, I'm going to do this to make toys, to make as much money as possible so that I can retire early and then be incredibly generous with children's organizations. And he did all of that exactly as planned.
All right. Well, now I feel bad.
And then when his kids had grown up, he's like, noble. I'm going to go back to directing. And that's when the new Star Wars movies came out when we were kids.
Should have given up. He should have stopped there.
I like the prequels.
Well, you didn't tell him in time.
Yeah, I know.
He didn't make the sequel trilogies. That was somebody else.
Yeah,
sold that to Disney. Anyway, let's get back to
I got Reservoir stats. Dogs. I got this stats movie. For you. So, 8.3 out of 10 on IMDb.
This is quite possibly the most distracted we've been at the beginning of a show.
This is great. We're still getting everything. We're still moving. Number 98 in the top 250.
Yeah,
not bad. Not too shabby.
Yeah.
Pulp Fiction's number 8 or 9.
Yeah.
So like Tarantino has a top 10 movie in the IMDb top 10. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't expect anything less, though.
So that's impressive.
He's like he's one of those actors. You can put him in a category with like Spielberg and like
Nolan.
Yeah, and just be like, oh, this is you got to have a Tarantino in there.
Yeah. What's this movie's history on the IMDb 250?
So this debuted at 23 in 1996 when the IMDb Top 250 launched. It dropped to 60 by late 1999. So over the course of about 3 years. It hung between 60 and 70 until March of 2013, and then it stayed between 70 and 80 until August of 2019, and it hit 90 in 2021. So it's still in the top 100,
but it has slowly
slid. But I mean, like, it held between 60 and 70 for 14 years, right? Half of my life.
Yeah. Rotten Tomatoes, it's got 90% tomato meter, 94% audience. So that's not bad. Not bad. The budget for this film is what?
$1.2 to $3 million.
Oh my gosh.
So originally it was only going to be shot for a few $1,000s.
That's amazing.
And because the guy that plays Joe was going to bankroll it. But then Joe handed the script around to, and got other producers interested. And that's how they were able to get the acting cast they got. But it was 1.2 to 3 million somewhere around there, which would be 2.7 to 6.7 today.
That's nothing.
That's impressive. Nelson, can you look this up real quick?
Sure.
What was the budget of his most recent movie, his 2019 Hollywood movie, whatever the full title is for it? But
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. Curious, like if he's always...
No, the budget, Django probably was, Django had to be massive.
Okay. And Sin City with all the CGI and stuff.
That's because of all the N-word cards they had to buy.
Yeah.
Sin City would have been expensive.
So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was 90 to 96 million.
That's still cheaper than what I thought it would be.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Let's look up Django, though, because that one probably is more expensive.
I would have thought so just because the location, but also the effects. There was a lot of explosions. So
what happens in Django? Like what?
There's explosions.
100 million. The budget was 100 million in 2012. So
That's significant. What about, I am curious about Sin City because... It's kind of weird. It used to be like CGI was very expensive. Now they really get screwed by
40 million. And that was in.
Wow, that's not as much as I thought it was going to be.
40 million. I mean, if you think about it, depending on how you shoot it, like it might have been in one soundstage.
Full filter.
Yeah.
They shot that in a really short period of time, too. And also, Like, we're like, oh, we've got this actor for this many days. We can do all their scenes. I watched a documentary on it.
Do you like Sin City?
I've never seen it.
Okay.
I like Clive.
I always watch documentaries.
I like Clive Owen a lot. He's one of my favorite actors, for sure.
I like Owen Wilson, too. So,
I like Luke Wilson more.
I like the Wilson from... I didn't think of that. That's a good one.
Is there a name drop in this movie? By that, we mean, does at any point in the movie somebody say the name of the movie?
Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
I don't think so.
No, the closest to that is the opening credit crawl, where it introduces all the actors and says, are Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, they don't say the thing.
All right, I want to talk about the opening scene.
Do it, you won't.
The diner scene?
Tarantino is making a case that Madonna's Like a Virgin is about a woman who has been very... has had a lot of sexual partners, but now she's with a very well-endowed man, and...
I can't believe how eloquent you're doing this.
And he, for her, the sensation is similar to having sex for her very first time. And one of the other actors in the scene says, no, it's about a woman who's been very mistreated, and now she's falling in love. And so it's a passion, and it's not like a, you know... And he doubles down and speaks a little further. So I want to read... just the first verse and chorus.
Oh, no.
of
Madonna.
Of Madonna. Okay. Like a Virgin.
He thought he was going to read the script.
This is going to be the most explicit episode we've ever had.
This is going to be so many quacks.
Okay.
I made it through the wilderness. Somehow I made it through. Didn't know how lost I was until I found you. I was beat, incomplete. I'd been had. I was sad and blue, but now you made me feel, yeah, you made me feel shiny and new. Like a virgin, touched for the very first time. Like a virgin, when your heart beats next to mine.
I just feel like she didn't have to use the word virgin. I know, I understand.
Oh, she's just being provocative.
Yeah. Because I feel like, I know she's talking about like feeling like, you know, you experience puppy love and then you experience real love, which can be painful and difficult.
Yeah.
And like, you make me feel like puppy love again. But instead she chose to use, because it's Madonna and she's...
provocative.
Well, and now she's really gross.
Yeah, she's super
good. Lord.
Oh, one of my favorite memes is a picture of Madonna and Roseanne Barr in the 90s. And be like, who would have guessed which one would have been the hot one now? Yeah. And like, some pictures of them now. Roseanne Barr has really put it together.
Yeah, right? She's pretty.
Lost the weight.
She aged well.
She aged really well.
And even though I'm sure she's still
canceled or
got some serious Botox in her, she doesn't look like an alien.
Roseanne?
She's got to have some. They all have some.
I've listened to her podcast. I'd be shocked.
Really?
Yeah.
Just based on her personality?
Mm-hmm. And all the conspiracies she buys it on?
Yeah.
Like, she's not putting anything in her body.
It just never... Yeah, I guess. After a few experiences recently, I'm just not surprised.
Not bad
by
at all,
anyone.
Roseanne.
Yeah.
She's got a Hillary Clinton-looking vibe, though.
She is...
Like, just from what I know, how she used to look.
She does. She kind of looks like a female politician.
Yeah. She is absolutely hilarious, though.
Yeah. Now, I found out there's lots of, like, normal, everyday people, women in my life who get Botox on a regular basis. Yeah. And one of them is my age.
Have you ever considered it?
No.
It weirds me out when, like, 20-year-old women or women in their 20s are getting, like, lip fillers.
Yeah.
And you look like a freak.
Yeah. He looks stupid. Well, no,
talking about you, Stacey. I don't know anybody.
Oh yeah, Madonna is a train wreck.
Yeah, she looks bad.
Yeah.
Anyway,
she looks like some alien woman.
She does.
So, here's my question.
Opening scene, diner. That's where we were.
Yeah, here's my question. The lyrics to Like a Virgin are publicly available, even in the 90s. And even in that scene, somebody else corrects Tarantino's character saying, no, it's about this. And he still goes on to say that it's about what the thing he says it's about. I don't understand what the purpose here is.
The whole scene?
Yeah. And also, like,
I can tell you.
I
have it.
I know male locker room type talk.
Yeah.
This isn't it. This feels
fake, illogical
and inorganic.
Yeah. No, this, so Tarantino likes to, well, there's two reasons. He wanted to build Mr. Orange. No. Mr. Pink's character. So the whole thing about the tipping.
Yeah.
That, like, he doesn't tip.
I like,
which honestly, in today's culture, he kind of hit the nail on the head. Yeah. 30 years.
We're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
I assumed we would.
But that's part of it, was building his character. But also Tarantino loves to go from like almost meaningless, like slow and meaningless to like extremely fast, loud chaos. And then back again. So this is actually
a distraction.
It truly is just a bunch of nonsense. Like they're, you know, the one guy's like reading out of a book and it's driving Mr. White nuts. He's like, what are you talking about? And these guys are talking about Madonna. And he's like, what are we doing? Like, we're professional. Like, we're supposed to be professionals here.
Right.
And
we're supposed to be professionals about to do a diamond heist.
Yeah.
And we're at a diner.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Yeah. But part of it is building their characters a little bit. Okay. You kind of get the feeling that Mr. White is the like patriarch, which he kind of is.
Mm-hmm. Most seasoned.
Yeah. You get a little bit of everyone's kind of vibe. And also Mr. Pink, you learn a lot about his selfishness.
I don't think it's selfish.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that in a second. Back in the 90s.
92. I think it also did a really good job of like setting up some of the chemistry between the characters too. It's like, even though they were saying nonsensical things, at least at the beginning before the tipping point, it doesn't matter what they were saying. I think it was more like, how does this character interact with this character? How does this character respond to this character? It's like, you did get a lot of, not necessarily specific character building, but team building chemistry from that one conversation before they even leave the diner. So I appreciated that, even though like the whole conversation, I'm just like, really? Really? This is how this starts? So now, Nelson, before we get,
yes,
because this isn't as important as what you're about to say.
Oh,
this movie did a thing that I learned a couple episodes ago that you hate.
Yeah.
This movie specifically did it. The you're in the middle of a conversation, and next thing you know, the conversation goes to a different location geographically.
And the conversation is continuing
from the very, I would never have noticed that up until you and I had that conversation. Like any other time, I just
did you write down what was that? Did you document it? Do you remember what it was?
This was the story of our antagonist.
We don't know, and we'll probably have differing opinions on who's who.
We were learning about his story about how he had made the decisions he did to get up to where current time was.
Mm-hmm.
So he was retelling his journey to where he got.
Did you know that the exact thing we talked about in LA Confidential is a similar theme to what makes the protagonist and the antagonist of this story who they are?
Be more specific, please.
No, I like it vague.
In LA Confidential, we talked about chaotic good, evil good, evil bad, whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Evil good. That's not a thing.
Moral ambiguity.
Yes.
Evil good.
And it depends on how you identify and where your moral compass lies is how you will identify who the protagonist and who the antagonist is in the story. I'm going to probably leave it there because you have more to say about
tips,
something.
I'd love to come back to that.
We will. Because we have to. That's the whole, basically the premise of the whole movie. But
yeah, I thought of you all watching this, Nelson, because they did the thing.
Yeah.
Because it's
I know that the Tim Roth's character, Mr. Orange, there is like a montage of him going through his practicing telling the story in different locations. And for me, that doesn't really count. I didn't notice a moment where there was a scene change, but the conversation continued.
Well, the conversation stayed the same for us as the audience, but maybe it's what you were describing in where he was rehearsing his thing. Because there was a scene where he was, I'm trying to remember, one of the scenes is where he's standing in this big wall and it's all graffiti.
Yep. Okay, yeah, when he was rehearsing.
But that was the second point. And when they showed him there, that's when I realized, oh, we're still in the same conversation, but now that's when I noticed it. But he was rehearsing.
He's rehearsing a lie.
Okay.
To tell.
See, and I received that moment as, I guess I didn't pick up on the fact that he was rehearsing. I received it as he was narrating to us, the viewer, what was going on.
No.
In like unchronologically.
Yeah, no.
So like, I didn't catch that as him rehearsing.
Yeah.
So that clears that up.
It was a montage of him rehearsing a lie so that he could like grow his cover and get on this jewelry heist. So what Jeff's talking about is in Snatch, for example, there's a scene where two characters are having a conversation, and to move them further along in where they need to be in the story, we have like these smash cut scenes. But in reality, that would have been like a 5-minute gap in time where nobody's talking before somebody responds to what was just said.
Sloppy exposition.
I hate it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. That makes a little bit more sense. Okay.
So Mr. Pink says, I don't tip. I don't believe in it. If she doesn't make enough money, she can quit. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. And he makes a joke about a sexual favor. And somebody says, I'd go over 12% for that. And the funny thing to me is like,
you would too?
In 1992, that's supposed to be like very generous. But tipping culture has changed even so much that like the percent that you're supposed to
give. The minimum percent is 15.
Is going up and up and up.
Yeah.
It's getting to 20% in most metropolises.
Yeah.
The reason for that is minimum wage hasn't changed that much. Restaurants continue to pay roughly minimum wage. And so it's expected that the customer fills in the gap there. But the prices of things are going up because of money printing. We talk about inflation in almost every episode. And so I think it's really... I actually agree with Mr. Pink here, where he says, if she doesn't make enough money, she can quit. Somebody says, but this is a hard job. And he says, you know, when I was young, I worked a minimum wage job. Nobody paid me tips. Working at McDonald's is a hard job, but you don't feel the need to give them tips. And then Mr. White says to him, waitressing is the number one occupation for female non-college graduates in this country. It's the one job basically any woman can get and make a living on. The reason is because of tips. And Mr. Pink, in his like last speech about the topic, says, hey, I'm very sorry that the government taxes their tips. That's messed up. I'm self-censoring here. I'm just gonna say it, then we'll put it out in quacks. That's messed up. But that ain't my fault. It would appear that waitresses are just one of the many groups the government on a regular basis. You show me a paper that says the government shouldn't do that, I'll sign it. Put it to a vote, I'll vote for it. But what I won't do is play ball. And this is non-college bullshit you're telling me. I got two words for that. Learn to type. Because if you're expecting me to help out with her rent, you're in for a big surprise. I agree with Mr. Pink here.
I have a semantics thing, though,
okay,
to interject here. I don't know if this is still the way it is, but I know it used to be.
Yeah.
Servers would get paid servers' wages. Servers' wages were a fifth of what minimum wage was.
Right.
So when I was coming up and through like grocery jobs when I was a little, you know, young man, 14 mm-hmm. to 17 squirt. Years old. Yep.
It was still wet behind the ears.
Still wet. There was a store that I worked in, the upstairs of the grocery, and there was a restaurant downstairs. And everyone wanted to work there because they paid real minimum wage.
Yeah.
And you got to keep your tips.
Yeah.
But most jobs, like minimum wage at that age for me was like $7 an hour, $6.50
yeah.
or $7.
Yeah.
For servers, it was $2.15.
Yep.
So that's just something to consider, that when what he's saying is like, I get what he's saying.
Yeah.
Totally. But I'm like, without your tips, they literally make almost nothing here.
Right.
Like they,
well, yeah. So a few things. In most states, minimum wage for a job where tips are expected and minimum wage for jobs where they're not are different. So if you're stiffing waitresses on tips, you are actually stiffing them on their survival. Wages.
Yeah,
yeah. But I also agree with Mr. Pink that like if you're in a position where getting stiffed on tips means whether or not you make rent and you don't like that, find other work.
Right.
Right. As he said, learn to type. Pick up a different skill that's going to make you more marketable. And even further than that, like I oppose minimum wage in the first place. Like I don't think there should be a minimum wage. Minimum wage, some people say that minimum wage should be zero, and I even disagree with that. If you want to pay for the privilege of having work, that's a arrangement that I don't understand, but you should have that right.
You let's know? Try that out.
That's right. Because, so for example, let's say that you're a high school student, and you really don't need money. What you just need is some experience in the job. Like maybe you're willing to sweep up at a barber shop, and you don't really like a couple bucks an hour. That's all you really need, just to get some experience in the workplace, and you'd be happy with that. Like that's part of the whole labor negotiation. I have the right to take any amount of pay that I consider acceptable, and you have the right to offer any amount of pay you consider acceptable. But the government steps in and says, no, you have to pay at least this much. Well, there's some people whose labor isn't worth that much, and you've just priced all of them out of the market. In fact, the history of minimum wage in America is explicitly to price out minorities. Like, that's where it started at. So,
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I'm going to play devil's advocate, though.
Yeah.
Wasn't that place there not for the barbershop and the high school student, but for the corporation, similar to a union? Like, it's a noble cause.
Right.
Like, it's like, yeah, band together because we want... we demand like pay worth our value, and if we're all together, they can't say no. So isn't minimum wage kind of like the federal way of doing the same thing?
That's the revisionist history of it. What it actually is let's say hypothetically, you and I are both very bigoted factory owners.
Okay? We're, yeah, sure. Pretend in air quotes.
Yeah. The pretend part here is that we're factory owners.
I'm really having a hard time believing this, guys.
So you and I are both bigoted factory owners in the Reconstruction era of the South. And we have to pay everybody for the work that they do. There's no minimum wage yet. And you and I have competed on quality, on cost, on efficiencies, and we're basically neck and neck, and neither of us can eke out an advantage. I'm marginally less bigoted than you, and so I see, oh, there's this whole untapped market of labor, and I can pay them less, and their labor is basically as good, and I can train them to be better. So I start hiring black guys. And you think that this is absolutely beyond the pale, and you won't stand for it. And so you go and you lobby your senator, hey, we need basic minimum wage laws so that people can earn a living, right? Like that is where it started. It's well documented. We retroactively like to consider it to be this altruistic thing, but no, it was to price black men out of the labor market. It also prices out the mentally handicapped out of the labor market, and other people who are low skill for whatever reason.
I just didn't know. That's not why I asked the questions.
Minimum wage is also one of the many reasons outside of us printing money that are the value of the dollar keeps.
Yeah.
Because people keep demanding that,
demand better
pay. To pay more means that they have to spend more, just like it raises everything. So raising minimum wage isn't going to solve.
No.
It's just going to make everything
more expensive. Recently, we talked about this not too long ago, Nelson. Mm-hmm. Ohio recently did a campaign.
Yeah.
To raise minimum wage. And I'm just like, no, because everything else will just go up with it. It won't solve the problem.
Yeah. Well, you're describing the disparity of minimum skill to minimum wage.
Right.
That's what I was describing. What he's talking about is when you raise the minimum wage, what you also do is you may raise the cost.
The whole economy goes.
So then the prices for whatever service or product you provide also have to go up because now you have to have staff, but then you also have to pay them staff, and to afford that you have to raise your everything also, goes up when you raise minimum wage. And the reason
people keep demanding minimum wage be increased is because they don't even understand why, but because inflation ruins the value of the dollar. What they were being paid, which used to be valuable, is no longer valuable. If you took what a minimum wage originally was, it was 75 cents an hour, and they were silver quarters. And you take the value of those silver quarters today, you're twice of what the actual minimum wage is, right? Because they've devalued the value of the money, they've changed the value of the money. Like that's the issue. Now, shortly after COVID lockdowns, everybody was fighting to find decent labor, right? Not to find work so much as to find...
Because no one was wanting to work.
Well, for a variety of reasons. Right. Some of them legitimate, some of them laziness. But McDonald's was offering $15 an hour.
Yeah.
Right? That's 2.5 times minimum wage, I think.
Aldi's...
It's singular.
I was working at a... Aldi's was... Lindsay and I had a real hard time because I really liked working there. But what I was making and for the work that I was doing, Aldi's had a sign. Their starting wage... Aldi had a sign that their starting wage was... $2 more than what they were paying me.
Yeah.
And that was after my first year's raise. I'm like,
yeah,
this doesn't make sense.
Right.
And
what you were doing was more skilled labor than what they were hiring.
What I would imagine was more difficult. Now I've not worked in a, I've worked
it,
in.
It was more physical, but what you were already doing was more skilled.
Correct.
So do you think.
So just that, I struggled with that. I was like, I liked what I was doing here, but for more money, I could do a, it doesn't make sense.
Is that a symptom of corporate greed? Or do they have a bad business model? I'm not saying them specifically. If it costs me $10 to produce this thing and I sell it for 20 and I've grown the business to the point where I can't keep up, I have to hire you and pay you $5 for every sale. So now I'm down to $5 net. Mm-hmm. And then now I have to hire a shipping manager and I have to build a warehouse and all these things. And my margin goes down to $1 per sale. And then I tell you, I'm sorry, you're going to have to get paid that for the rest of your life. I know it's ridiculous, but is it that? Or is it, Tim's over here pocketing $18. I'm making one and the company makes one.
I don't know.
I don't
know.
I
really enjoyed the company. I appreciated my time there. So I like the people I work
for. I meant that as a larger rhetorical question.
Right. But for that specific company, I don't know.
I would argue that it's not corporate and for two reasons. And I'm actually going to debunk two things at once here, one that wasn't even brought up.
Prove it.
I'm more of a bunker kind of guy, less of a debunker.
We'll often hear that women get paid, I think they're saying 83 cents on the dollar now. It used to be 75 cents on the dollar.
Good for them.
And this is easily demonstrably false in that if this were true, businesses would only hire women because you could cut your costs by 15%.
Yeah.
Right? So,
of course, then who would make the sandwiches?
I don't know. I've been to Subway and sometimes it's men.
Yeah, I need to eat. Well, how would that work?
So that's two things there. Obviously, one of these things isn't true then. Either it's not merely corporate greed, or men and women, like, it's not necessarily true that women get paid 83 cents on the dollar. On the gender wage gap, there's plenty of evidence to show that it has a lot more to do with maternity leave, choosing not to work after you've had kids, types of labor done, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Gender.
Genitalia, that kind of thing.
That's a big factor.
Those are not the same, apparently. So
I remember
gender and sex are two different things.
Yeah. And also with the rise of transgenderism, if this were true, women would just check male when they're filling out their HR stuff to get an extra 15 cents on the dollar.
It's true. I identify as male.
The reason it can't also be merely corporate greed, if we look at the people funding the lobbyist groups for raising minimum wage, it's like McDonald's and Starbucks and Burger King. Yeah. People who are already paying more than what that is, right? They don't actually care. What they want to do is they want to price out anybody else that, because of their business model, has to hire labor that is within that smaller range. It can't be corporate greed because the data doesn't bear it out. Now, are corporations greedy?
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't think they're any greedier than anybody else.
Right.
I don't think corporations are uniquely greedy.
Correct. Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, there are. Yeah, but
anyway, diner scene. That one's over. What was next?
Yeah, that's how we usually handle the show. Yeah. Do you have a follow up question for my claims about corporate greed? And
I still think there's some more. The words are hard today.
Yeah, yeah.
The word I'm looking for is nuance. I think there's more nuance to it than just saying, like, it's all lobbyists and government, you know, getting their hands on everything. I think there's, like, it's hard when you see, and it's easy to pick on Jeff Bezos because he's the biggest, most richest dude in the world. But, like, if you split up
it's my namesake
some of his money within his, like, even his corporate level people, like, not just the average worker, like, does however many billions of dollars support, like, what would that come down to? You know, it's kind of like if they just split up the lottery and gave it to one portion, equal portion to everybody, is it even enough to make it worth it?
No, like, if you took Elon Musk's net worth, liquidated it without losing any value, and gave it to everybody in the world, you'd have like a couple dollars each.
Yeah, well, I meant
that sounds good to me.
I meant within his company.
That's a soda pop, but like,
okay, so then it's also a question of so as we clarified in LA Confidential, Tim, you've got quite a laundry list of high demand skills.
True.
And you charge quite a bit for it.
I do.
And not because you're uniquely greedy, but because, you know, among other things, if I put this dollar sign on it, it communicates my value, my quality.
Oh yeah.
It also weeds out the riffraff. It establishes that I'm not so easily replaceable. Now, I do find the work conditions of Amazon workers kind of deplorable. I think those Amazon workers should find other work.
Yeah.
For FedEx.
I don't think unionizing is going to fix it, because we can see so many other places that have unions, like FedEx, that also have terrible conditions.
You just...
then they should all go to UPS.
You
just
made mini circle there, didn't you?
If I worked for you, right, it wouldn't make sense for you to give me half of the value that we got on the shoot, because I'm not creating half of the value for you. I'm creating at most like 5%.
That's being generous. No,
yeah, so. I'm in the way.
Right? I would enjoy having you there. Your presence would be enough to make it worth.
I need to pay for the privilege. Right. So, like, I understand that it feels unfair, but like, how do we define what fair is? Right. How hard is it for me to replace you? That's going to be a major aspect of how much I pay you.
That's why my job is very relational. I was looking through my assistant, because we talk a lot about this, because he's just starting out and he asked me a lot of questions about value.
Yeah.
Not, and he's like, I understand like time, quality, and money, like value, like money, like the actual dollar amount. But he's like, all you Americans talk about value. And I'm like trying to figure out, I kind of explained that to him. I'm like, my value is that I learn my customer's industry as well as they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I can actually catch mistakes and things that like help them sell a product that they don't even think about, because I'm like an extension of them.
Yeah.
And they value that. And to me, or to them, it's worth paying me the money.
Right.
Because it's like, Tim's like an addition to our team that we don't have to pay all this overhead on.
Right.
And
also, if somebody sexual harasses you, HR doesn't get involved.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, I know that's a joke, but You're actually right, though. There's a lot of policies and procedures that I can skip around.
You're a lower liability for that.
Yeah, 100%. But he sent me a quote, but I realized how much we text, so now I can't find it. That actually kind of sums up what you said.
You can search your text messages.
I don't do that. I don't know how to use a phone. This is my first time.
We got to unflip it first.
Okay. Raise
prices.
Can you
work with technology?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I just don't play around with phones very much. If you could have a billboard anywhere, what would it say? He put it right in the heart of San Francisco, and here's the reason. The number one theme that companies have when they struggle is they're not charging enough for their product. It's become conventional wisdom in Silicon Valley that the way to succeed is to price your product as low as possible. Under that theory, if it's low priced, everyone can buy it. That's how you get to volume, he said. And we just see over and over and over again people failing with that because they don't get into it, because they get into a product called Too Hungry to Eat. They don't charge enough for the product and be able to afford the sales and marketing required to actually get anyone to buy it. Is your product any good if people won't pay more for it? That was a
Little Reddit thread.
Yeah, a little Reddit thread. That
was that
a
him
quote
to you?
It was a quote from a guy named Mark, M-A-R-C, who's a
Cuban.
Business. Yeah, I don't know. But
the grocery store guy.
We talked about Marks. This because he's been a starving artist for so long.
Yeah.
He's actually been net negative on some shoots.
Just because he's not charging well.
Because he's afraid to ask for what he's... And worth. I'm like, it's not even what you're worth. It's like the standard rate. Yeah. Let alone that you're an exceptional photographer.
The minimum wage.
Yeah. Well, no, he...
Probably making way above minimum wage.
No, in those instances, he was making literally net negative. And we were quoting a job for a customer, and I was like, this is what I would charge. And if you want, I can work backwards and show you how I arrive at that number. Yeah. And I would be glad to do that. And I did. And
that's awesome.
Even though we were offering him like a volume discount, he was going to do 4 total video productions. We were basically giving him 3 for, or 4 for the price of 3 if he committed to all of them. And the guy went back and forth about like value and how this is going to change this landscape of his business. Like, it sounds like you understand. And like, but he just keeps coming back with tactics of like, well, I'm going to go to my mentorship group and see what they say about the pricing. And then he'd come back. He's like, oh, is there any cash discount? We're like, I know it's all about money. But fortunately for me, I've left that world behind me about 2 years ago, and I'm stable enough that if you say like, we just can't make it happen, I'll say, thanks. If you ever want to do it, give us a call. And if not, it's cool. It's great to meet you. Had a good time talking to you, learn about your business and yourself. Whereas my assistant is like, what's the like Hail Mary low number? I'm like, we are already there. Yeah. Like this,
we gave him the number.
Yeah. And this is not, if he doesn't value it, then
right.
Who cares if we get his whole circle of business
well,
come
it's,
to us?
It's also, so subjective value theory, Austrian economics here. Part of the subjective value here is, does your potential customer value your services more than he values the money, right? Because if he values what you're doing more than the money, he'll make that deal.
Yeah.
Right? And but because of subjective things like what his business is at right now, he might need that money more. And that's entirely reasonable as well.
Sure.
Right?
And you're absolutely right. And,
because value is not an objective thing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, diamonds would be worth less than water.
Right. And he pulled out a pretty arbitrary number. He said, when I make an investment in marketing or creative services, it has to return at least 10 times the value. And I said, that sounds like something an Instagram real estate mogul, air quotes, would say.
Yep.
And it's nonsense. Because first of all, you know this is not...
And how do you even measure
that? We can't quantify that.
Yep.
It's impossible. You can ask people, you can, every time someone closes a deal with you, you could say, hey, how'd you learn about us? And they, even if they did see the video, that might not even be the forefront. They might have said, we Googled it, went to your website, we saw the video, but that we don't know if that's what changed their mind, but it doesn't matter. You know what you need. You sent us an example of what you wanted. We said, this is what it costs to make that thing happen.
Yeah.
Now, where I have an edge is that I don't have bloat. I don't have a huge agency. I have a bunch of subcontractors. I own all my own equipment. So whereas I'm actually always going to come in about 30 to 50% less than everyone else because that's built into the business. I own the equipment. Yes, you're renting it from me on the day of, but I'm not charging you for it.
Right.
It's built into my cost. So I told my assistants just watering at the mouth to close this deal. And I'm like, let him go somewhere else and ask them for a quote. And when they come back for the same project for 30,000 and we're just under 10, I don't, I'm actually worried that we're undervaluing so much that he'll say, wait a minute, why are you guys so cheap? Are you guys going to be doing a bad job?
Yeah.
And I'll say, no, this is why we're relational, but we're also slim. And
you're all encompassing lean, everything.
We do it all. Like I'll pull up with the job trailer.
And also you're in a position where your past content that you've made can speak for itself. Like you can still present it and say, hey, I made this.
Well, that's how, right. I mean, that's initially how we even got into conversation is he's a painter. He owns a large painting business that has lots of employees. And I
Leonardo.
Yeah, that's the guy. DiCaprio. Did the Sistine, Sistine Shutter Island.
The 16th Chapel.
He painted the Shutter
Island. But yeah, he saw on my resume that I had worked for Sherwin, and I still do some work for Sherwin, and just thought, well, this guy works for Sherwin. He can.
He knows paint.
Yeah, and it's true. And I charmed him with my knowledge, which is.
He wants a video of paint drying.
Literally, and I have made that video many times for years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Value. So far from Reservoir Dogs, although you did touch on Diamonds, which was the score.
Yeah.
And by score, I mean not the music. I mean the score of the heist. Mm-hmm.
So can I say, this movie, as entertaining as it was, this is the worst heist film ever.
Oh, yeah.
You don't you don't see
this
it.
This is not Ocean's 11.
No.
This is the opposite of Showdown.
You don't see the heist at all.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was very disappointed. Well, we're 20 minutes till the end, and I'm like, okay, we're about to get to it. And it never got to it. Like,
it was originally a budgetary decision. And then he's like, you know what? This gives me this budgetary restraint gives me opportunities to really lean into certain elements.
I love that. It's literally every other aspect of the heist except the heist itself.
Yeah,
I love that.
He also did put things on screen intentionally. What you just said, show no tell, but exact opposite.
Yeah.
When he cuts off the officer's ear, he made an intentional. I watched some behind the scenes of this and. He made that decision intentionally. It wasn't to save some money on special effects or makeup. It was, we know what's happening. It's going to make my guts turn inside out, but I don't need to see it.
And then he shows it.
But then he shows it, and also all the shooting he shows, too, to show how like quick and impactful shootings happen.
Yeah.
And like, it's just...
So much violence happens off screen
and
on screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre.
Well, there is a lot. When I was looking up like Easter eggs and stuff for this, there was a lot of things that happened off screen that have been speculated for ever since this movie came out. The Mexican standoff at the end.
Yeah.
If you slow it way down, there's never a bullet that hits the sun.
Yeah.
Like no one aimed a gun at him. So like people are like, oh, it's Mr. Orange did it because he was dying, but he wasn't dead. Or Mr. Pink did it. He was hiding under the ramp.
Yeah.
Or
he had a gun in his hand.
He did. There's a whole bunch of speculation.
Yeah, I watched it and I was like, who shot Eddie? And I rewound it and it looks like Mr. White shoots Joe and then gets shot and turns and shoots.
He just, if you slow it way down, it's like he wasn't even close.
Yeah.
But also like the very end when Mr. White gets shot, like you hear a bullet, like a gunshot.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't wince at all.
Yeah.
He had the gun to Mr. Orange's head.
Yeah.
And then you hear a spray of gunfire, which tells me that the officer saw him with the gun, said, put it down. You can hear them say that. He shot Mr. Orange, and then they just laid into him.
Right.
But it's all, you don't know. Yeah. It's all of your imagination. What's the point? I don't know.
I like that.
I do too.
I think largely, and it's one of those things, again, where it's largely a budgetary restraint. So it reminds me of this story. There was this... elementary school that was relatively in the middle of nowhere, but then a highway was put in pretty close by, and the kids started playing like really contained on the playground equipment and kind of nervous until they put fencing in. And once the fencing in, the kids would play all within the boundaries of the fenced in area. And it's this thing where when you have a lot of options, it can be kind of paralyzing and scary, and so you stick to what you know. But then once you've been given a boundary that you can't really go beyond anyway, it's you have a permission to explore within that boundary.
All the corners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he made artistic decisions that were quite interesting that are born out of a budgetary restraint.
A financial boundary.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a lot of low budget movies in general.
Yeah.
They find creative ways to do things and you're like, whether it's practical special effects or just like rewriting a script a little bit. It's like, well, we could do it this way, but it's going to cost this. I'm like, let's do it this way. And then it becomes iconic.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa.
And it's something that you wouldn't have thought to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like the thing you would want to do is, I want to do a grisly ear-cutting off scene. Well, I can't fit that in my budget.
Does
I thought they weren't going to show the ear at all. So when they did show the ear cavity, like I was like,
Now for you guys that have seen other Tarantino movies, like does he depict violence in other films?
So like, you talked about comedy earlier, and like there's kind of like ironic comedy and there's dark comedy, and like his other movies, like Django, you didn't see it yet,
not yet.
Okay, so like he dials it up a notch to where like you shoot someone in the chest. If you've seen someone get shot in the chest in real life, if they get hit in the vitals, the spine, anywhere, he's Googling it. This is dangerous. Game.
I'm just looking up.
Live League is gone.
I'm just looking up Django Unchained. Okay.
So like he shoots someone in the chest and in real life, they usually just fold in half and go straight down. You know, if you hit something vital or a spine, when you shoot someone in Tarantino's universe, they fly back 75 feet and smash through a wall. And you're like, okay, even he knows this is way over the top. And it is. So like
in Django Unchained, somebody gets hit with a shotgun blast and goes flying.
Yeah.
In
an absurd way. Like flipping through the air. And then like you shoot someone and you see like, well, Kill Bill is the same way. There's blood spray that is like, it's not impossible to hit a major artery and have it spray like really hard like that for a few seconds. But this is like, they're losing not just gallons, but like gallons upon gallons of high pressurized. And so to answer your question, this is hyper violent, but probably the most realistic depiction of violence of Tarantino movies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Have you seen Glorious?
No.
Okay. He hasn't seen a single Tarantino
movie. This is my first time. Yeah.
And Glorious, there was
my first.
When I saw
the bear,
Jew and the baseball bat.
Yeah.
That I've never been nauseous from watching a movie. But for some reason, that just got me. Like, that was like, oh, man, this makes me feel so not good.
Just from searching Django Unchained, just looking at the picture here, that's not the movie I thought it was. There's another Samuel L. Jackson movie I'm thinking of.
Oh, this is Jamie
Snakes
Foxx.
On a Plane.
No. Hold on.
No, it is Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, it is, but he's the
house.
Butler.
Okay, hold on. I'm thinking of the...
Jamie Foxx is the main character.
For the longest time...
He had a great one, by the way.
Yeah, he's terrific.
He's awesome.
I want to make sure this is it before I... Okay, I was thinking Django Unchained was the movie Black Snake Moan with Samuel Jackson.
Totally different thing.
Because I didn't realize it was a Western. Django Unchained. I didn't realize from the pictures, it looks like a Western.
Yeah.
So, okay. Sort of. I was thinking of Black Snake Moan, which is a Samuel Jackson movie where he's got this girl chained up in his yard. And I thought that was the movie. So, okay, I was crossing these. Okay.
Wipe your brain palette, because it is not that. This is about a slave and a love story. And
a beautiful story.
Yeah. He fights his way back
that's
to
2 weeks from now.
Yeah, but you'll...
We'll get there.
You'll get there. And how I'm sure this was done on purpose, but you're reviewing with one of our few and only black friends of the area, because there's not many around here.
Yeah.
And it's a movie about slavery, which is pretty bold.
It's, So I've wanted Isaiah to do an episode with us for a while.
We'll talk. Sometimes about it's been him just not getting back with us.
Well, it's usually him saying I don't watch movies,
right?
But
this has been a long
one
time.
One of the reasons is there's a handful of movies in the IMDb Top 250 that I think it would be inappropriate for Jeff and I, as two white guys, to
discuss.
You guys
are white?
We are.
Dang.
On the inside.
Now, as much as I scoff about the whole representation matters stuff. It is true that there are certain conversations that require additional inputs, additional experiences to really discuss responsibly. And so I was like, Isaiah, here's a handful of movies that I really don't feel comfortable with just Jeff and I. Would you be willing to come on for any of them? So that's what we're having him on for.
So that said...
And I hope to have him on for movies that aren't about the black experience as well.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah. That said, we talked a little bit about the wage gap earlier. Would you ever consider having a woman? No, yeah, good.
We've already had several, and I'll never do it again.
Sarah's coming back again for one of our...
Oh, yeah. Well, she doesn't count.
There's so many levels of sarcasm
that I can't tell what's actually...
We've had three serious. And then a fourth episode that never aired.
We've had three, and two of them have been repeat guests. So there's an interesting aspect in this movie about racism. Mr. Pink says, you ever work with... I'm self-censoring because I can't say this word. I'm not comfortable saying this word. They're always saying they're going to kill each other. He uses a racial slur, but evidently from what he's talking about, like, he's worked with them.
Yeah.
So he's not so racist that he refuses to work with them. I didn't quite know what to make of this. And then later in the movie, there's the whole conversation about how black women won't put up with any amount of
Malarkey?
Malarkey, we'll say.
Yeah.
And then somebody comments, well, black men seem to treat their black wives and girlfriends really terribly. And Mr. Pink says, I suspect that's just for show in public. And in the house, it's very, very different.
They, you know what, though? They don't, if you notice, they don't exclusively go after black people either. They talk about Jews, too. I think that this is, again,
and Asians,
where I think that Tarantino takes some liberty with what he thinks reality is for these gangster type people, is that they have this like code, you know, their baseline morals,
yeah,
that only applies to them. But things like that are not off limits because at the end of the day, they are scummy people.
Right.
So that again goes back to our LA Confidential and our morality.
Well, let's go to that real quick.
Yeah.
Because
I don't think it'll be quick.
Specifically talking about scumbags.
Yeah.
Scumbags.
Mr. Orange talking to his officer in the first scene that we see that we meet his commanding officer. He says to him, do right by him. He's a good guy. I wouldn't be inside without him. And he says, no. Long Beach Mike is not your f***ing amigo. Long Beach Mike is a f***ing scumbag. He's selling out his amigos. That's what kind of a nice guy he f***ing is.
Yeah.
However.
My daughter hated this movie, by the way. she struggled with it.
However, Mr. Orange becomes friendly with Mr. White. And now he's in a situation where he's responsible for him to go into jail, but really responsible for all of these men dying in a way.
Yeah. That's why at the end he tells him he's a cop on his deathbed because he feels a moral obligation to say like, hey, I did this. Like, and it's not, it's
you,
like,
you I'm don't sorry, think he's
almost like apologetic.
You don't think he's gloating?
No, not at all. I think he feels extreme remorse because I think over the course of their relationship, he built almost like a fatherly relationship with him. And it's like at the end, he's like, I screwed up. And he actually is not good.
I would say that the main character, our protagonist, our hero in this, and they're all tragic characters, but our hero in this, I would say, is Mr. White.
Yeah.
Which is Buscemi's, right?
He's the
Mr. Pink.
Patriarch.
Oh, that's right. He's Pink, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at my cast again.
It could be White or Pink, honestly.
Pink?
Oh, Mr. Yeah. White. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be White or Pink. Orange is definitely, this is why we hearken back to L.A. Noir or L.A. Confidential is because we talked about
you did it too.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. It was Confidential in my head the whole time, and then you started saying
L.A. Noir Financial.
Yeah, L.A. Confinor. Anyway,
Pink in the Brain, L.A. Narf.
Narf.
You guys are so dumb. I can't believe anyone listens to this.
Seven people do.
Dozens nice. Of us. Yeah. Dozens.
Where are you willing to draw the line? And Orange shoots a woman in this. A civilian.
Yeah.
And like you could
argue. Well, she shoots him first.
Yes. Yeah, so you could argue that, you
she
know.
She shot a cop.
Cops are going to return fire, but he was carjacking her.
Yeah.
And like he pushed the line so far that it's almost impossible and irrefutable to say that he didn't push too far. Whereas like in LA Confidential, Russell Crowe's character, you're like, okay, he's willing to like snap some people's arms,
right,
but he will never hit a woman and he lives by an ethical code of some sort. So it's kind of, to me, very similar as like Mr. Pink has a very strong, and Mr. White have very strong code of ethics and moral standards. They're just in some ways, it's very different from ours. Obviously they're criminals. So
this reminds me of something that we talked about with Snatch, right? In Snatch, obviously fixing fights is wrong. But is it wrong to fix the fight in such a way where you actually just have the fight, but then screw over the people that you broke a contract with?
So the fixing negates
the fixing,
the gambling aspect of it.
Yeah.
But it does.
It's still fixing a fight in a way.
It does get retribution on someone who tried to screw you. Yeah.
So the question here is
multifaceted.
Obviously, vehicular theft is wrong, murder is wrong, violence is wrong, the theft of the diamonds is wrong, all of this is wrong. Do you think it becomes do you think that Orange's actions up until, you know, killing that woman, but being complicit in this bank robbery or diamond heist, do you think that that's acceptable? Do you think that undercover policing like this should be allowed?
I think it was a lot more clear in this movie that he went too far too soon.
Okay.
than in like LA Confidential, where you're like, I don't know, like if
was there were... undercover policing?
No, no, and no, not. Okay, but you know what I'm saying, like the more pushing the moral envelope to where you're like, well, if you're breaking a like a suspect's arm to get information, knowing that they just want you to stop, they might give you the information you want, even if it's,
they talk about that in this movie,
even if it's wrong.
Yeah, he'll tell you that he what was the line? He'll tell you he started the god Chicago fire.
So I think that it was a lot more clear very soon in the movie that Orange, I don't know if it's because of his relationship to White, if he felt like an obligation to him, or if he got too much in his own head and was like starting to enjoy it a little bit.
Yeah.
Or if he genuinely just like, I'm going to do whatever it takes to take down these bad guys.
To take down Joe specifically.
Yeah.
Do you think undercover policing should be something that we as a society allow?
Boy, I think that is a fair. I hate saying nuance because they like that's a cop out. But it's weird. It's kind of like making drugs legal. Like I don't know what the right answer actually is.
Yeah.
Because or if I even have a theory about it, because I just did some training with a group here in Ohio that does that. They do drug buys.
Right.
They're not worried about weed. They're not even really worried about coke. They're doing, like, they're worried about meth. They're worried about fentanyl.
Heroin.
Heroin. The heavy hitters.
Yeah.
And a lot of what they do is undercover buys. And then they roll the little guys into the bigger guys and the bigger guys. And, you know, then they do these huge raids.
And they get them on tax evasion.
Yeah. And and they post bail and they're back out in the streets and, you know, killing people. It's great. Our justice system is really smart.
We spend a lot of money to catch them and then release them immediately.
Yeah. And then tell them if they don't come back, there will be repercussions. But the repercussions are probably already 25 to life. So just you might as well just go to Mexico.
Might as well run.
Yeah. I guess that might solve the problem anyways, because then they're gone. But so to that degree, I don't know. It's kind of like this will never be on the IMDb top anything, but like Minority Report. Like they pre-establish that you're a criminal.
For us.
Yeah. But the premise, though, is this: is that you have these... psychic creatures who can tell when a crime is about to happen. They go stop it before it happens. And it's like, well, we don't know if the crime would have happened. So it's
right.
And it's similar in that way. Like if you didn't buy the drugs, I don't know. I just don't know the answer. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about it.
And then there's also the question of like, we have plenty of documented cases where FBI, CIA, or even just policing, police departments doing undercover work end up being, what's the word? End up actually doing entrapment, right? There was that plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer. There was 12 people involved. 10 of them were federal officers.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, okay, so it really seems like the federal officers were trying to kidnap Governor. There was a situation where there was a sting operation of illegal weapons. And it turned out that all of the sellers were FBI and all the buyers were CIA.
Yeah. So I guess to that point, like what you said about the governor being kidnapped.
Yeah.
It's like, at what point are you perpetrating or perpetuating the crime and like pushing it along and saying
and honestly, that kind of thing can happen entirely without malice.
Yeah.
Right. Because you're just like, we're going to get these guys. And you don't even realize that that you're so excited to get them that you're actually the one that's really pushing it.
Yeah.
You're moving some of it
so
forward.
I guess to that degree, I would say there's probably a cutoff somewhere of like what these guys do that I was training with last weekend. Mm-hmm. Like they go into, like they know there's drug deals happening.
Of course.
So it's not like they're going in and saying like, hey,
who's your guy?
Sell me, you know, 50 grams so I can cut it and then sell it to 50 individuals.
Right.
And like perpetrating a drug operation. Right. They're going in and saying, hey, can I get a little bit of this? You sell to me, I arrest you, and then say, hey, you're going to get 5 to 10 for that. I can get you 2 to 5. You got to flip. And then that's really how they operate. So to that degree, I'm like, well, no, I have no moral issue with that. The illegal action's happening.
Right.
I always struggle with this concept. I love Law & Order SVU.
Mm-hmm. SUV, Ford Explorer.
Was there an episode where the police was raping people so they could catch rapists?
So there's this whole storyline of an undercover agent who's a part of this trafficking sting, but it's long, like it's a long term thing. Like it's not just an overnight thing and then they're busting it. he's undercover for multiple months, like a lengthy amount of time. And with specifically SVU, they always deal about sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, this, I never really put much thought into it on the drug side of things, because I'm just like, drugs are drugs are drugs. But like on this one, like I struggle with that whole arc, because the whole thing was these guys not necessarily illicitly moving it forward, but just watching things happen without taking action.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that. Like, and so I never thought about it on the drug side until this conversation, but now it's just like, it probably does happen trying to catch traffickers.
There's
like, definitely happens. But
where in that line would there be a line that's being crossed? Are they crossing lines in that line? It's like, how far do they become?
Yeah.
I've always struggled with that end of it.
Isn't
because that, I'm like, they're watching, business transactions. How deep do they let that go, knowing that those transactions leads to other actions?
That part of the plot of what's the movie the actor played Jesus?
Yeah,
Jim Caviezel.
Jim Caviezel.
Yeah, what's the movie that he was in that was very controversial?
Just recently,
for no reason.
Yeah, like Freedom. It shouldn't.
Yeah, Sound of Freedom. It shouldn't be controversial.
I watched 5 minutes of it. I can't.
Well, it's not good.
I have no palate for stories about children being violated in such a way. And so we were like 5 minutes in, and I'm like, I know where this is going, and I know that they're going to be very tasteful with how they handle this, but I can't.
No. Well, it's also...
Did you watch it?
Yeah.
He watched like 400 hours or something crazy.
Yeah. And it's all a true story. I listened to the pod... The only reason I watched this is because I listened to the podcast of the actual person,
mm-hmm.
and that's... It's a true story.
There's another actor that did a similar one. So there's this ex-Special Forces guy that just, he's got a crew of guys, and they go into places that are suspected of them, and they're like a private black ops, right? They don't work for the government. They just go and bust heads and
Dog the Bounty Hunter.
And rescue kids from sex slavery, and also rescue child soldiers. And I think he's incredible. And they did like a movie about it. It's like Machine Gun Preacher or something like that was the movie about this guy. And like, this guy like used to be a rough dude, right? Like his wife is... Like they met when she was a stripper, right? And he was one of her clients, and now they're both Christians.
Gerard Butler,
yeah. Yes, Gerard Butler, Machine Gun Preacher,
old G Butt. We used to call him.
That movie sucked, but like I like the story. It's a true story.
Yeah, I love that.
29% Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, I feel like that's part of that gig. Is you? I mean, there's a difference between perpetuating and then turning a blind eye. Or just letting certain things go in order to get the bigger, which sucks. I mean, I don't think anyone's denying that, but it's the same reason why cops don't care about, oh, you got a little bit of weed. I'm just going to submit it for destruction. It's not even going in evidence.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I don't care about you.
It's not going in evidence. It's going to my house.
Yeah. I care about the truck that's coming in. That's got supplying weed bricked up in the tires. You know, like I care about that. So I had more things to say, but I lost them.
Specifically about the movie or specifically on the conversation we were having?
That conversation.
I apologize.
It's all right. It's not your fault.
You have any other movie insights you want to discuss? I'm out of stuff.
No.
The only thing, which this may come up again when we watch the other Tarantino films, but like some people, how do I want to explain this?
Are gay.
There's a lot of there's a lot of violence in this movie. I don't know how to react to that, Nelson. Some directors use violence as just a point in the story to move on. With the way you guys have talked in this conversation and from what I saw in this movie, like, do you think Tarantino uses violence to further, do you think he uses it as a deeper tool than just violence move on? Like is violent and graphic body is dysmorph? I don't know. What do you
mean? Like does he, is it symbolic?
Right. Like, is it something that he intentionally clings to just to tell stories? Like for him, like
100%.
He's like, what's, is there a deeper meaning to the violence he does? Like
hyperviolence has always been his thing, always. Okay. But also he loves going to the extremes, just and usually it's violence. So he loves going from extreme, like nonsense, quiet, like kind of a mundane exposition into like just someone getting lit up with 17 rounds in their chest and blood flying everywhere. Mm. That's his way of exposition. That's his, like, his storytelling style. And it just happens to always be violence instead of, like, you know, other people. It's like rockets flying, skyscrapers falling,
dialogue.
Yeah.
Just straight monologues the whole movie.
Yeah.
It's like unnecessarily big type stuff, but like not in like the same way as, oh, who's the director that did Transformers? Michael Bay.
Michael Bay.
It's big, but it's not like Michael Bay big. It's a different kind of big.
It's a it's still shocking.
Yeah.
It's just a different, it's hyper violent shock.
Yeah.
I just didn't know, like, for, like I said, just from the conversation, like, if for this director in my future journey with these rest of these movies, like, it, does the violence mean something more than just
I honestly think that that's the most like for him, that is the least symbolic part of it. That is purely shock and awe and violence. And
there is one other thing in this that we didn't talk about. There's no women in this.
Well, one gets shot.
The ones that get shot. Yeah.
There's that one. There's no women in this.
Actually.
And when he was putting the movie together, that was feedback he was getting from producers, is like, hey, you need to have a woman in this. You need to have some romantic conflict.
Shot her.
And he was like, no, I don't. This all takes place an hour after a bank robbery. None of them are bringing their wives around. Yeah. And I was like, that's a good
point. He was like anti-woke before woke was even a thing.
Yeah, and he continues to be.
Yeah.
One of my favorite interactions surrounding, I think it was the media circuit for Django Unchained, and we'll talk about this again in 2 weeks, is this young reporter said to Samuel Jackson, hey, Tarantino has a reputation of using the N-word a lot. And Samuel Jackson's like, what N-word? And he's like, well, you know, he's like, no, I don't. And he says, you know, it's a racial slur for black people. He's like, say it. And the kid's like, I'm not, I can't say it. He's like, well, then I'm not going to answer the question. The kid's like, it's a good question. He's like, no, it's not. He's like, it really is. He's like, then say the word. He's like, I can't say the word.
Oh, man.
And I love that, right? I love that, that there's people that are really not putting up with the political correctness.
If you were the kid asking the question, would you have said the word in front of Samuel Jackson?
To Samuel Jackson? No. I would have laughed. I would have been like, that's hilarious. I understand what you're doing. I don't feel comfortable saying the word. We'll move on. I wouldn't have doubled down saying it's a good question. I would have laughed. I would have thought it was hilarious. But that kid's career would have been ruined. Right?
Or elevated.
No, no, no.
Like,
no,
you don't think Samuel Jackson would have tore him down?
I think Samuel
L. Jackson would have loved it. Yeah. I think that
the kid wouldn't have had a career.
Though. Everyone else would have been like, you're the dude that used the word.
So what's the difference then? Like, again, maybe this is something we need to wait for Isaiah, but like, what's the difference for an interviewer to use a word that the actors or actresses use as part of their interviewing question?
Yeah.
Or an actor like Steve Buscemi to say it on screen. What's the difference? So a white guy can say it in front of the camera, but a guy can't say it when trying to market for a movie?
Tim, let's get your input.
Like, again, maybe this is an Isaiah question.
We're going to revisit with Isaiah for
sure. But if a white actor can say it on screen, why can't an interviewer say it about the movie
cultural,
to a black actor?
Cultural norms.
Yes.
That's really the only reason.
You say it worth the squeeze.
No. I did. Okay, so, and it's funny you say that because Isaiah... I worked a music festival with Isaiah. We were setting up and tearing down, and he kept...
Is that one where those guys got trampled to death?
No. It was in Worcester, Ohio. It was not...
Fire festival?
There's only a couple hundred people at this one. All old drunk ladies who hit on me a lot, which is fun, by the way. I had a blast. Shout out to CWPD.
It was
best
a great
production
time.
Company in the world.
We get to have Clint on here.
Yeah. Clint would be fun. But I...
Whiplash.
The entire time we're there, he's trying to get me to... This is pretty early on in our friendship. We were probably 3 or 4 months in, which is ironic because I helped get him hired.
Yeah.
Like I was on the HR committee that got him his job.
I've worked at the same.
The entire night, him and this other guy are trying to get me to say the word. The other guy is just a white dude who likes to joke around constantly.
To be provocative.
Yeah. Isaiah is like, just say it. Like you have my permission. Like just soft.
And Isaiah doesn't even say it.
No, but like, you know, A at the end, not ER. And I was like, dude, I will never, like, I will drop F-bomb just because of the, like, only the certain amount of ways you can walk, even though you're in an open air music festival.
Yeah.
It's like to go back to the job trailer, you have to go this way. And like, we had rain covers on things. You'd like walk in and we just kept like running into each other. And eventually I was like, move. And he laughed so hard. He loved it. And he thought it was the best thing. He's like, I'm going to tell Jen. I'm like, please don't. I'm like, if you do, I don't care. You've told me no less than 30 times to say it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to catch you off guard when I said it. And I think I did.
Yeah.
And I will never do that again.
Yeah.
So that's the one time.
Yeah. So now every time you say it to him, he won't be off guard.
Well, I use the hard R.
I'm going to sample what you've just said. That's going to be my, whatever you text me, that's what I'm going to get.
That'd be so.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
No. Oh, no.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't. Can't spend all this. I just don't like those words in general. It's weird. It hurts me. It's kind of like when someone says Jesus Christ. It literally hurts me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, don't do it. Like, why do you need to do that?
Yeah.
There's other words you can use. And like, if
I used to be that sensitive, even with when people said, oh my God.
Yeah.
That would like, and I've become somewhat desensitized to it. And I don't think that that's, I'm not saying that's right or wrong.
Yeah. I want to know, I am curious to see like how grows up in a very white world. Like, I just, it is.
We censor her name. I'll make sure to quack it
out. We'll see.
Well, I mean, this isn't even part of the podcast. This is more just me.
Lindsay and I, we're
white. I know. That's why it's weird.
But like, we're in this mix, like, and we've had conversations with Isaiah about this. We've had conversations with her hairdresser because we take our daughter to a black hairstylist every once in a while just to make sure that it's healthy and keeping up. Like, so we have people in our lives that are helping us and supporting us, being that we're in a transracial family and stuff. And like,
because you identify as black?
No, transracial.
I was going to ask what the actual
transracial
term is.
Means. It's, you know, biracial being like if I was black, Lindsay was white, and we had a mixed child.
Yeah, yeah.
Transracial means a different race kid comes into a different raced family.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Lindsay and I are both white. Our daughter came in black. It's a trans race.
Let's say hypothetically, Lindsay had a first child out of wedlock and you adopted, like you married in and became the stepfather. Is that transracial?
I don't.
If you're both white, then no.
No, if the kid's black or half black.
So yeah. me coming in, I guess there'd be some,
as long as one of the members of the family is a different
race,
which race is so dumb. Race. We're all humans. So we're all race.
When people talk about like social construct, race is the most social construct of all social constructs.
So anyways,
but yes, I see what you're saying.
We
transracial family, take her to get her hair done.
We're on that scale of like sometimes being like, we try to be chill about it. Like, okay, she's going to be raised by a family that loves her. And that's all that's the main importance.
Yeah.
But on the other end, we're also like, we become hypersensitive in moments where we're like, we just want her. We want her to be individual. Like we want her to be an individual who knows where she came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes we'll up.
You don't want her to feel like she has to act any certain way, but at the same time, because of that, and you want her to be familiar with her cultural heritage, you act a certain way and encourage it. And you don't want to go too far that way either.
But then you throw on the other layer, the fact that she is adopted and that she's going to listen to this and she's going to find that out.
She does listen to this.
Have you
ever
seen the movie Great Country Bears?
No.
It's about a bear that's adopted and he finds out when he's like 14 that he's adopted into a human family. you know, like, stay this way?
The other
pretty much the exact same thing that you're talking about.
Right, like that other factor is just like she has a past that has baggage.
Yeah.
Most of which she's not aware of and we're not aware of.
Yeah.
So like we don't want to shy away from talking about her past. So we do talk about we don't want to do too much, but at the same time, we don't want to not do it at all. Like it's a hard balance to try to make sure that our influence one first and foremost is love and protection and nurturing. But at the same time, like we want her to be like, if she wants to go deep dive into where she's come from, we're for it as long as it's safe. But if she would rather just be like, I don't really care. Like we're here now, let's just move forward. Then we're also cool with that. Right now, she doesn't really have a voice or a conversation with us. Like we don't know where she's going to want to go, but we want to make sure she has those opportunities. So the biggest thing for us is we live in a predominantly white area. We our goal is just to make sure that she sees herself represented somewhere else at least one other time a day, whether it's in music. Whether it's in the cartoons she watches, whether it's in the books we read, whether it's in the music we listen to, whether on screen or where we go to live music, whatever. Like, we just want to make sure that she sees someone else like her at least once a day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that she just sees herself represented outside of herself at least
once a day. I have a question for you about that. So, you know how major movie studios have been blackwashing?
Yeah.
So
you mean erasing redheads?
Yeah.
Travesty.
Yeah. Well, they have no soul. It doesn't matter. But
still travesty.
I don't watch these movies. I never would. They're not even, even if they were something that piqued my interest, like remakes of movies from my childhood, regardless of who's been casted, I'm never going to watch them. But then I see them getting, you know, some of them were intentionally only female crew who obviously had no clue what they're doing because the movie's trash. And then they cast a black person in a historically white role, which is like, I don't understand that.
Right.
Like some things make sense. You know, Jesus was Middle Eastern, but we always think of him as a blonde hair, blue eyed, long hair dude.
He was
dude.
A very handsome white guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he was not. He was probably, he probably had curly hair, yeah. a really nice full dark beard, and dark probably like, skin. Yeah, darker yeah. skin. But
in hobbit feet.
But how do you feel being both a father in a transracial family, but also seeing this like effort to be, I hate using the term woke, but you know what I'm saying? Like, right. you're.
They're shoehorning a representation in ways that don't feel.
So,
yeah, do you want Jazzy to grow up and be like, hey, this is a movie they made.
And so you're the target market. So
you're the
like
target
it.
Market, but it's trash. And here's the original, and it's a classic. It's iconic. It's beautiful. It's well
so
done.
A good example is the movie Annie. Jamie Foxx was in a remake not too long ago where he was, it was completely blackcasted.
He's dated Warbucks.
Except for,
the orphanage.
What's
lady?
Her name? What's her name?
Miss Hannigan.
Yeah, there's a white actress.
Oh, they kept Hannigan. The villain a white person. Interesting. Yeah.
So, but
wild.
For that one, yeah, I have not seen that one yet. I'm a Jamie Foxx fan.
Yeah,
but like, but well, I have not watched that one. Like, and, because for me, even before being a father, like the one with Cara Burnett,
is
iconic. So like for me, it's just like I just haven't had the desire. Now, an instance where maybe. Did it need to be done? No. But was it done well? Yes. Would have been the most recent Karate Kid movie. Mm-hmm. So okay, I'm not saying it's the best groundbreaking film of all time, but it was
Jackie Chan.
It was Jackie Chan and Will Smith's son, Jaden Smith.
Oh, yeah.
It was
very much went off the deep end. It was the whole Smith family.
Right,
but
right. It was a well-made film, though. It was fine. It wasn't over the top. Yeah. Like,
no, and I didn't feel like that was blackwashing. I didn't feel like they put him in there to be like, we need a black kid.
No.
Now okay. I feel like we're but, in that.
Because that was before that was even happening. Correct. I'd say that the Jamie Foxx Annie was right at the tip of the spear of the whole.
What's another example, though? Of
like the Little Mermaid movie that was terrible. The Snow White
I haven't watched
movie,
Little Mermaid.
It was terrible.
Snow White's not out yet, but it will be terrible.
Rachel Zegler's in it.
A lot of them.
They've already canceled the theatrical release.
She-Hulk was another one that, maybe not necessarily racially, but.
What was wrong with She-Hulk?
So She-Hulk is adapted from the comics. And like there's a She-Hulk in the comics, and it's a pretty faithful adaptation, to be honest.
Yeah, the Disney Plus was just very accurate.
But the movie sucked.
It still sucked. Yeah. The show sucked.
The show sucked. It was not great.
So if you're trying to be profitable as a studio, you would read the script right. and do the screenplay and say, hey, this is going to net negative. Let's not do this.
To finish your question, like Lindsay and I are not necessarily looking out for modern renditions or anything. Like if there's a modern original release, yeah, we're like we listen to a lot of modern Christian hip hop right now that my daughter's into. Like she enjoys it.
Yeah.
But what's more important for us is we listen to the classics. Miss Lauryn Hill,
Aretha Franklin,
Etta James, Lizzo. I'm not necessarily looking for things that are being redone. I'm going for the things that established authentic black culture.
Even like what you're going for, not going for, I guess just.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I would love to talk to, black people about this. Is like
I'd love to talk to a black person.
Yeah, there's not many around.
One day.
And Isaiah's not, he's fine.
No,
but
he is a black person.
He is. But I mean, in terms of like, he's a black person who's always lived in a white person's world. Right. So like to talk to somebody and be like, do you ever have a desire as a black dad to show your kids a movie in which the main characters have been replaced intentionally by black people, but it really just is a crappy movie? Like, so, I'm not saying that their being black takes away from the story.
I'd say it's more than just blackwashing too. It's a shoehorned representation, whether it's any perceived minority. So it's going to be shoehorned homosexual LGBTQ representation, shoehorned female representation, shoehorned racial minority representation. And there's good and bad ways to do it. Sometimes it's blackwashing, like you said, but sometimes it's like Captain Marvel, where it was a largely female cast, female director, and it was a commercial failure. And people were like, oh, it's just because people hate minorities. Okay, well then Black Panther, which is a predominantly black cast, black production crew. Right, like even as far as like who was catering, like they went out of their way, and it's a phenomenal movie. People loved it, right? So like it's not even a thing of like people don't like minority representations. People don't like bad content.
Yeah.
No, the Marvels. I enjoyed the movie Marvels, but that's not this.
You're an anomaly.
That's not that. No, I'm not. That's a different conversation. I'm not the only one that liked that movie.
I didn't say you were.
Okay, but
I did. I hate all Marvels.
Anyway, I know. Okay.
You know,
the majority of the audience did not enjoy the Marvels.
You haven't seen it.
I didn't say I did.
I know. I just
the majority of the audience
watch it and then give me your opinion.
The Marvels.
You're not. It didn't do well in the box office. That doesn't mean that people didn't enjoy it. It just means that people didn't go out and watch it in theaters.
That's a pretty good indicator.
There are websites where people can put their own reviews of movies.
Yeah.
And the majority of the audience has not enjoyed the Marvels.
Okay. Anyways.
I'm not saying you can't like it.
Tim, specifically, you mentioned The Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
Have you've watched the new rendition?
I would. That's what I was saying. Is I
did you watch it?
No, no.
Okay.
I have no
We have not watched it yet either. We were going to watch it with our daughter. It's got a little bit, there's some spooky, like there's some jump scares in it. Not spooky, but there's some jump scares in it.
Why?
Ursula, she's a frightening character, some moments where she jumps out.
Oh, you meant in general.
Woman.
I thought you meant like in the new version they added specifically.
No.
Yes,
she's
right.
Just a frightening
there's
character.
Some creepy stuff in
as
there.
We started it, we realized very quickly that it's a kid's movie, but not a toddler movie.
Yeah.
So we stopped it. But in general, Nelson and I have talked about specifically Snow White. Yes, the Snow White character is a white, like, she's known because her skin is
white as
snow. Yes. So that one, yes, I can kind of see where there's some issues. A fictional, mythical creature as a mermaid, that one didn't bother me as much because the character already is...
A Norwegian not something, fairy tale.
Right, but, like, it's been done in other races already. So, like, This isn't the first time there's ever been a black mermaid. So, like...
And I don't
like,
care about and
she
that.
She sings really well. She's a great actress.
She's already got fish eyes.
It's true.
What is that supposed to
her eyes are. She got some.
Anyways.
Eyes like, are too far
like,
apart.
I have not seen the movie yet. I'm eager to watch it. But, like, but that one specifically did. That one didn't feel like it was blatantly going. Because like it wasn't an all black cast. She's the only black cast.
Perspective
yeah,
is.
Frightened's not black?
No.
So is she adopted?
Javier Bardem's in that movie. Javier Bardem is King Triton. So like she's the only black actress in the movie.
I'm
eager to watch that one.
I don't care if they replace. I don't even care if they replace Snow White with a black person. My question is if it is making the movie worse. The remake is worse because you went out of your way to hire all female, all black, all white. I don't care if you went out of your way to make it homogenous in some way,
right?
In order just to represent
Devi
someone.
Diggs is in it. He's black.
I think here's a way we could step back from even just cinema and kind of talk about
affirmative action is where I was going with this.
Well, I entirely agree with you. So here's the thing. If the decision-making process is we need a black Little Mermaid, who can we cast? Right? That's one thing. And that's largely how it felt presented. If the conversation is let's have additions, we're gonna do blind editions too. So we don't say we want to hear some singing voices and talking voices, have them read lines, and they decide she's the best one. That's great, right? And I think that's an important thing. But the diversity and inclusion has been so force fed that anytime there's diversity and inclusion in a movie now, people become immediately skeptical.
Right.
A really good example of when this was poorly executed. When Joe Biden secured the nomination for the Democrat Party in 2019, he said,
"The Lord of our Savior,
my vice president will be a black woman." That's just pandering. It's not saying, I'm going to look at all my options. I'm going to pick the best person. I believe the best person from what my options were was a black woman, specifically Kamala Harris. Instead, he said, it's going to be a black woman. I will let you know who later. Like, that's what a lot of this stuff feels like, and that's what people don't like. Because now the quality has all become secondary.
Yeah. Yeah. And whether the intentions of the film, the music, the whatever category of life we're talking about, like no matter what the intentions are, like because everything else seems to be on this woke agenda type of idea of like we got to do something that's relevant, so we have to bait and switch things. Like we're so prone to assuming that anyone that's put in a position that's different than what we would have expect is because of
because it's so ham-fisted. Right. Now it's always called into question.
Right. So like it does happen often. It's like I've not watched Little Mermaid. I don't know. I've listened to the soundtrack many a times, but I know it does happen. But just like.
I don't know that The Little Mermaid was that, right?
Right, I don't either. Like, and
I'm skeptical because
there's only two black actors and actresses, and one of them's face is not even on screen.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know. But something like the Marvels felt more normal to me than the moment in Avengers Endgame, which I don't
they
know.
They did it in both. They did it both in Endgame.
There was a scene in both of them.
Yeah, but okay. Endgame was the more iconic one.
Okay. Where like, all our somehow all characters. The women are fighting in the exact same battlefield zone and they just happen like
they do a relay race.
It was
with a hammer.
In the time as it felt in the same moment it
I'm
felt
not even joking, that's what happens.
In the same moment where it felt a little like, okay, this is cheese. There was a moment of like, okay, it's pretty cool. It's cool to see a lot of bad women doing something bad, but it didn't feel natural in the movie.
I tried to as so like, we so recently was, watched through the MCU movies with our kids, and I tried to as best as I can not communicate to my kids how I feel about this stuff beforehand, because I want to see, does my daughter light up at this? When we watched Captain Marvel after, I was like, so what'd you think? First female superhero movie, like, well, she's like, this movie really sucked.
Yeah.
and that's to her just like not being impressed with the movie.
Yeah. Just objective and like totally just, yeah, I don't know.
We should get into rapid questions about Reservoir Dogs though.
All right.
Reservoir Dogs?
That's the movie we watched.
Reservoir Dogs?
Dogs.
Dogs?
Dogs. Like Dags?
You guys watched
Reservoir Dogs?
You guys watched the same movie I did? All right.
What is that?
I was an accent I'm working on for a character.
You need more. Either more work or stop doing it.
I think I'm almost there.
You need to try harder or less hard. I'm not sure which.
We can do this last bit in all accents just to spice it up.
What'd you got? So.
you didn't even say any words. And it was the worst thing I've ever heard.
I can't
didn't
do accents.
Didn't you do improv for a long time?
Yeah, not accents.
That was his Caribbean accent.
Yeah, a Caribbean person who's drowning.
I was doing an accent recently.
On stage.
Would you guys recommend this film?
Yes. Well, to who? My wife?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, that's the big one here. That's,
yeah. But like you guys? You oh, bring, yeah. Okay. I mean, one of you guys even brought it up, or Nelson brought it up, as it that it was available to review.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yes. Great movie.
Yeah. I think to the right audience, yeah, I definitely recommend. And this one would be a way easier for me to recommend than Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of the same issues with it. Now,
he hates the word orange. Always has.
No, it's just Clockwork Orange has
we haven't talked about this movie in a while.
Yeah, it's been days. Clockwork Orange has a lot of like visual sexuality, whereas this movie, it's all like
dialogue
sexuality.
There's actually an Easter egg that I forgot to point out. Can I do that now?
Please do.
Okay.
Time is up.
I just remind myself, Agent Orange, Mr. Orange. So Agent Orange was a weapon developed to hurt a few, but ends up hurting many. Because isn't that toxic gas, right?
Yeah.
Agent Orange.
Vietnam.
And that's someone pointed out that Tarantino named Mr. Orange that because he was originally supposed to be like a scalpel, like undercover, get the bad guys, but ended up killing, you know, inadvertently it killed
all of them.
Everybody.
That's clever.
So that was actually a little Easter
Do you
egg.
Think that was intentional on Tarantino's part, or is that somebody,
like that feels reaching?
Too specific. And Tarantino's like, oh yeah, sure, that's
specific
to be
I don't know.
On the nose.
I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, it's the right era. That would have been like post-Vietnam.
Certainly
like,
post-Vietnam. I don't know if Agent Orange, like the ramifications of it were quite known yet, though.
I don't either. I just, that's what somebody pointed out.
Oh, no, it definitely was because X-Files had already covered an episode on this.
Yeah. So he was the Agent Orange.
Yeah.
And he was meant to kill a few bad guys, and he ended up killing
everybody.
Yeah.
Including police officers, a woman, just everybody.
Interesting.
I would recommend the film to a specific audience, like not like it's definitely, we'll get into the rating here in a second, but like it's definitely not for everyone.
Yeah. It's gritty, violent.
It's
E for everyone.
But I appreciate, I always enjoy creative storytelling, and this story told a story in an atypical way. It was like, it was out of order.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that. It was done well in this instance. So because of that, I would appreciate, and I think other people would appreciate the way this story is told. This movie's rated R. Do you guys think you should change the rating?
Oh, no. It's definitely rated R.
NC-17?
In fact, I'd even be comfortable with like a rating above R for this, right?
Probably. So. I mean, the blood, the in its era, especially, the blood is a lot. It's just a lot. But like, if you compare this to like Saving Private Ryan, where people's legs are blown off and guts are hanging out, it's like, this is actually pretty tame in the grand scheme of things.
That ear
That ear was pretty gnarly.
It messes me up, man.
Yeah.
You're not an ear guy. You never have been.
He loves rats.
You
but
mean
he can't,
to talk to me about that.
He can't do ears. I would say the same. I got nothing to rebuttal on that. R works well. 1992. Has this movie aged well?
I think it's aged really great.
Yeah. I mean, from a technical perspective, anything shot on film in this era, it's just like LA Confidential. Yeah. It's a very similar era. It's gorgeous. It looks beautiful. The color palette's amazing.
The grittiness.
I love it.
Because of the nondescript costumes, which was both an interesting storytelling device and budgetary restraint, that holds up really well, except for Eddie, who looks ridiculous.
The jumpsuit guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in a lot, and you're definitely going to see this when we do Django Unchained. Tarantino loves using music that is
out of time,
but in this movie it's not as jarring because it's like we're listening to a 70s radio station.
I meant to look it up, but I don't know when this was supposed to be.
1992.
It was supposed to be in the era.
It came out in 92 and it took place in 92.
Yeah. And okay. Eddie's outfit could
have
fit.
As like culture references, there's nothing past 1986. I was paying attention because I was like, I want to see if I can nail down within the movie when it is. So I was paying really close attention.
Okay.
And they made a reference to a Madonna song that came out in 86. So it has to be at least 1986.
Yeah. Okay. That's my thought too. And then the song that Mr. Blonde is singing when he is torturing the cop.
Yeah.
I was like, it's got to be at least late 80s.
No, it was all 70s. Those were 70s hits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was weird.
When he walked out, so after torturing it and he walked out to go to the trunk to get the gas tank and the music like stopped because he left the building. That moment was so ominous because like he was just walking out, the music stopped, it was just kind of silent.
And he starts dancing when he gets back inside again.
Yeah, like but specifically when he's outside when it goes quiet, like I'm so prone in movies for to expect something bad to happen when something goes silent.
Yeah.
I was expecting his car to explode, for him to get shot there.
Cops
and when
show
he,
up.
And when he didn't get shot there, I'm like, okay, he's safe. So So that made him, when he did finally get shot later in the film, more unexpected for me because I'm like, I thought he was out of danger. Like it just, I appreciated the way he used music to dynamically shift the tone.
Yeah.
Grab the gas tank, walk out.
And then come back in. The music choice was also probably a budgetary thing.
Yeah.
Because not just was he picking 70s hits, so it's, you know, 20 years old, but he was picking obscure 70s hits. And then he worked it into the script to directly acknowledge
it. The one wasn't obscure.
Huh?
Well, the Madonna one and the one he dances to were
not obscure. No, the Madonna one is they discuss. They don't play.
That's true. But the one he's dancing to on the radio is a pretty, like, I mean, it's a recognizable song.
Yeah. I don't know how recognizable it was in 92. Right, like it could be that it's into the zeitgeist because Reservoir Dogs.
That's fair. That's
made
fair.
It relevant again.
That's fair. Last two questions here. Yeah. Would this movie be in your personal top 250?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of all the Tarantino films I've seen so far, this one would probably make it.
Of the ones I've seen, I'd actually put this lowest. Really enjoy Inglourious Django and Jane and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Inglourious that's a military film, right? Like that's
World War II.
I'm eager to watch that one.
Yeah.
It's good. The violence is off-putting. For sure. If you don't like this,
I love it,
then you're going to be like, what the heck?
I love it. When Tim Roth was just laying in that pool of blood.
This is different.
Let
this
me
is
get
like,
in there.
Very different.
Very different. Like just graphic
limbs
to the point where you're
flying.
If you've ever wondered what it would actually look like to see someone's head get bashed in, like they show it.
Oh.
Like it's like, it's not like.
Like Walking Dead bad.
I don't know. I would say
worse.
Worse than Walking. Oh, I'm gonna struggle with this movie then.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun
because graphic and like that particular scene specifically, it's like it's a realistic depiction. It's not like Hollywood bash head in. It's like oh, guts are like brains are flying. It's like that seems like that's what it would actually look like. Yeah. And they carve a swastika. I don't want to give too much away.
You want to be on for that?
No spoilers.
Anyways,
yeah. I want to watch it with you though.
Okay,
I do. I want to see
a pillow in front of my face.
Squirm.
All right, last question here, guys. We all answered that one, right? Yeah. Why do you guys think this is on the top 250? What in this film makes it a top 250 worthy?
It's the storytelling. And plus it was Tarantino's
It's his debut feature-length film, but there's been lots of directors that are iconic who their debut is not. This is a debut that's also just a terrific movie.
Yeah.
He took all the budgetary restraints and turned them into like successes within the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a triumph of filmmaking. I think it's overrated, but also underappreciated at the same time, like in a weird way.
Yeah.
So. That's a very weird way.
Yeah.
I can't compare it to other Tarantino films. Both of you guys can. So, like, you guys are, I'm going in a little bit more blind, but, like, for me, I think it was the way he captured the chemistry between the different characters. Not necessarily good chemistry or bad chemistry, but, like, the way they interacted as, how do I say it? Like, this movie didn't feel like it's this movie didn't feel comfortable for me. Like, this is an environment I'm used to, but at the same time, like, I believed every one of the motives of these characters and every one of like the, like when these characters made decisions, I'm going, that feels right. Like, just like the way these characters were directed,
yeah,
and the way they interacted with each other, even if I had a hard time listening to what they were saying, it felt natural and authentic between the cast. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that. And then on top of that, I think my favorite thing from this film was the way the story was told out of order.
Mm-hmm.
Not like Memento, Christopher Nolan out of order, but like, spoilers. But just back and forth. Like, I like that.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
Good talk, Jeff. Nice work.
What's that?
What was your...
Tim, how long have you been here?
What?
Did you just Tim, why here? Do you think it's in the top 250?
Did you just get here?
Well, I started to say we kind of
I meshed our words. I apologize.
Well, it's not. It's, I said the storytelling.
Tim, what do you think it's on the top 250?
Storytelling, technically, it was very nicely shot. It's color palette, exposure. Like, it, you can, I can definitely tell there's lots of artificial lighting, but in an era where that thing always falls down, drives me nuts. It's also scared the out of me.
I freaked out a little bit.
I thought it was a rat. I was about to jump up and out of here. Between me and the door.
Going that way.
If this ends up making it to air, a power supply on one of my computers just became unstuck from its adhesive and fell off my desk, and it freaked scared out of all of us. Iconic, definitely the storytelling, like Jeff said, it going back and forth between past, present, and future. And yes, it is, like, in terms of like a maiden voyage for Tarantino, like, he hit a home run. So
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And it really is timeless. Like, it's, the storytelling's cool. It's kind of like the Ringo argument from earlier. If you made that movie today the exact same way, would it be? And I don't know the answer.
I don't know.
It's also one of those movies where the entire plot is resolved if anybody has a cell phone.
Yeah.
Right.
Also, if everyone just kills each other at the end. That is one part of Tarantino, and this movie set the tone, is that, Jeff, you'll find this out as you watch more Tarantino movies. Pretty much everyone always dies at the end. And it's kind of like, when I watched Reservoir Dogs specifically the first time, I was actually pretty annoyed. I was like, what's the point? Everyone's dead. And then Mr. Pink, they allude to the fact that he gets caught by the cops right away.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't catch that at all. Oh, really? I thought he got away.
When, after everyone gets shot, and you kind of focus in on the one guy holding the kid, the cop.
Yeah.
Holding, white you hear gunshots outside.
Yeah.
And like,
gunshots and sirens. They allude to the fact that he didn't.
Like, no one makes
I didn't
it
hear
out.
The gunshots. I heard the sirens.
The guy grabs the bag, walks out.
Yeah.
And you're focusing on the two other guys dying. He's like, I'm a cop.
So it makes you go.
You're hearing pop, pop, pop.
What was the point of this entire story?
Sirens coming in.
Yeah.
Like, oh, so no one got away with this.
Yeah. So what was the point of the entire story? Just a bunch of dead people.
Yeah.
That is like a Tarantino trope, though, that he carries through most of his movies.
That's fascinating.
I'm not going to spoil Django, but even that one, it's kind of like,
okay,
just kill everyone at the beginning and save us 2 hours. Like, I don't know.
Django Chained.
Right? Yeah.
I felt like saying that and I didn't know how to fit
Very
it.
Very funny.
So, Tim, thanks for being on here. We appreciate
Always.
You. We love you. Next time wear pants. Next week, Nelson, a movie I'm very excited about.
I can't remember.
Inception.
Oh, that's why on the ride over here you said you're excited about Inception.
Christopher Nolan.
It was okay. Yeah. It was just okay.
This is one of Jeff's all-time favorite films.
It was the first time I saw it. It was. And then after watching again, I said, this is not that cool.
I don't think I've seen it since it was out.
The score? Amazing.
Hans Zimmer is beautiful.
Well, it's because he's just like, hey, how low can I tune this note? And then just make it as loud as freaking possible. I didn't want to use a duck right there. You've already used a lot of ducks this episode.
It's a duck-heavy episode.
We don't have a duck meter.
You should get one. Right. And then when you video record, you could actually like fill it as you're going.
I'm going to fill you as I'm going.
When we do eventually have video, we need to have a duck in the background.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's definitely on brand for you guys.
Like a little duck statuette.
Oh, you should get a full-size rubber ducky.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we would love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.